The Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics. Every 2 years, every 4 years, it's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. On this Horus Avengers Follow the White Rabbit, I'm going to be talking about pink rabbits, pink rabbit banksters, pink rabbits elitesters, what is known, what is not known. I'm going to talk about my opinions on certain things. We're going to talk about the largest group of pink rabbits, the Jew rabbits, where they came from in Eastern Europe, and what has just come out this year about what's in their DNA, or the potential of what's in their DNA. I'm going to talk about it from a variety of different perspectives. The first thing we're going to do is talk about the bankster class. Because what's interesting, Joseph P. Farrell and Bankster's Babylon's Banksters, it's an interesting book. In the end, he goes into the race in ancient Rome. And I'm going to give you a brief overview of the pink rabbit banksters and religion, and the elitesters and their religion. The religion is Talmudism. If you do any reading on Bob's Underground Graduate Seminar, you will see that Bob knows a little bit about the Jews and about their origin, probably much more than he's telling us. But one thing that he's always went back to that I found to be true is that, according to Josephus Flavius, and there's a couple other historians he talks about in Rome, one third of Rome was Talmudic by conversion. The whole entire Eastern Empire at one time prior to Christianity was Talmudic by conversion. And Talmudism was a dominant religion in Rome, what you think of as modern-day Judaism. Modern-day Judaism, most of you think they go by the Torah. Even some crazy Jews think that. They do not. They go by the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud. There's more versions than that, but the Babylonian Talmud. And, of course, it comes from Babylon. There are two times in our history that I'm interested in, Babylon and Egypt, the Hyksos of Egypt, and what actually happened in ancient Babylon. But there's another time we know about, and that's where the pink rabbit banksters came into Rome, how they got their foot in the door. And it comes under this religion, Talmudism. This religion, Talmudism, becomes rather fascinating because no one's read the whole entire Talmud. Yeah, your local rabbi has not read it. David Duke's not, you're not even allowed to read the thing, apparently. But there's many different versions and different things that have been released about it, but different things that have never been released. And we start talking about who was running Talmudism. Who was running this mystery religion, Talmudism, that you could convert to in Rome? And it was being run by a group of Pharisees who called themselves Jews. Some say all the Pharisees. Some say only a section. This becomes rather provocative because their competition, their competing group, the Sadducees, disappear from history. They disappear from history entirely when Christianity came out, along with another group. Another group that was a very, very powerful group that Bob has talked about on the blog, and that's the Druids. The Druids disappeared from the face of history. And we're going to talk about some different things. But the first thing you need to understand was that this particular Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters, in my opinion, have an alliance. I don't believe they're necessarily genetically related. I believe that the Pink Rabbit Banksters are, by and large, what you see is what you get. The ones right in front of our face are always Rothschild and Rockefellers. And they are, of course, the Rothschilds are most certainly Jewish. The Rockefellers, they come out of what we think of, this group comes out of what we think of as the black nobility of Europe. And we know where the black nobility of Europe comes from. They come from the Roman slave classes. They were a merchant group. And I'm going to read about it. I'm going to read to you this. But how did they come into Talmudism? Were they the Pharisees? No, they were not. They were not. They were a merchant slave class that worked themselves up. You know, slavery in Rome, the Roman slaves could handle a great deal of the household chores. They handled all the finance at one time. They handled all kinds of different things, and they worked themselves up and became freemen. And there's a certain group that got together, and I'm going to read you about that group, where they come from, the different researchers, and some of these famous families in Europe that are considered the black nobility because they're not European. I mean, they look European now, but they weren't. And there's obviously something up with them, because they basically supported pro-white genocide. But I always come into a lot of heat for talking about the Pink Rabbits, because on one end you have the racialists, and why don't you just call them Jews? Because you don't understand what the word Jew, you don't even understand the breakdown of this group. I know I didn't. I mean, how many of you knew that one-third of Rome was Talmudic by conversion? Who's running that? Okay, what's the relationship between the Pharisees and the bankster class of Rome at the time? Are they the same? Are they related? No, they're not. I don't believe they are. I think there's evidence that there's a breakdown, and I'm going to go into this. But then we got some interesting information about the Jews. The Jews basically came into Talmudism as a conversion. And so you have basically three different groups bringing Judaism and Christianity into Europe. You have what you think of as the bankster class, the black nobility. You have another group that we don't know a lot about, the ones that were running Talmudism, the Pharisees. They're extremely powerful. You have their competing groups, which will most certainly be the priest class. Obviously, a priest class is going to compete against another priest class that were wiped off the face of the planet. The fact that we don't know about them tells me a whole lot. And we basically have a situation of a bunch of Decepticons. That's what a Pink Rabbit is. It's a Decepticon. And a Decepticon in the movie Transformers can be anything. It could be any machine. But one thing it is, it's a killer. It is not what you think. And we have an enemy, and our enemy's motto is they wage war by deception. There's a whole lot to that statement. We assume that we've seen everything of our enemy. We have not. You've seen a huge critical component, a component that I believe in the last 300 years they wouldn't have a whole lot done without them, but at the same time, we don't know everything about them. So we're going to go in a particular direction, and I have more questions than answers, but we're going to put some things together. I'm going to break the group down as Pink Rabbit Elitesters, Pink Rabbit Banksters, and we're going to come back to this in the end, and I'm going to talk about the little Jew rabbits. I'm going to talk about what's come out on their DNA, some different things that are a little off the wall. But the first thing you need to understand about Babylonian banking, or about the banking that came into Rome, was it is not European. It is out of Babylon. It's a backwards banking out of Babylon. Typically, the state, and I went into this before, but this is, I'll talk about in the modern sense, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is a private central bank. There are two types of central bank. There's private and there's public. A public central bank is what China has right now. A public central bank can issue a true currency because it issues currency interest-free. Yeah, it issues a currency at 0% interest. And everything balances out. The amount of Chinese yuan in circulation is always going to equal the debt owed because the debt is zero. Everything's balanced out. Now, in the ancient world, according to the researchers, like the Joseph P. Farrells and Banksters from Here to Babylon, if you listen to the research he's pulling out of other Babylonian researchers, or even or even Egyptian researchers. Typically, a state is responsible for issuing the currency. But we have a movement afoot in ancient Babylon, and that's where it goes back to, and a Babylonian priest class, interesting enough. Now, who was the powerful priest class in Babylon? Well, the powerful priest class in Babylon were the Chaldees, and the Chaldees we know were Druids. Interesting side note. The powerful priest class in ancient Egypt was Ominous, and we believe those to be Druids. It's kind of like now you're looking at Christianity, and when you look at Christianity, you see all these different kinds of Christians. 4,000 years from now, someone will say, well, those evangelicals were obviously not Christians. Only the Catholics were Christians. You'd say, no. They're all just Europeans. They all look like they're doing something different, but they have the same root underpinning as Christianity. I mean, there's all these different types of Christianity, but they're all still tied to the same root. Well, that's kind of what you were seeing back then. In my opinion, why race is real. We can't change that. Everything you see Europeans doing now, to a certain extent, of our individual nature and the fact that we do all these different languages and all these different variations of Christianity would have been very much the same in the ancient traditions that precede it. Why? Because race is real. But anyways, in the temples of Babylon, they got going. And we know that they brought out this concept of a private central bank. And that what they would do is a private central bank basically loans money. There's a big difference between issuing currency and loaning money. You see, a private bank can only loan the principal. They have no way to deal with the interest. And that's the magic. It's a dead-end system. If you can put yourself on top of it, you'll have unreal control. But it's also extremely flawed because a private central bank can only issue the principal. It has no way to deal with the interest. And the interest on the particular debt grows. And the reason I call it debt is that's what it is. It's monetized debt disguised as a currency. If you pull out a U.S. Treasury note, it is just that, a note. A note is a debt instrument. And the amount of notes in circulation will never equal the interest. Why? Because the compound nature of interest always outpay, because the compound nature of interest, the interest on the notes will always outpace the number of notes in circulation. The two will never equal the other. It's a system based on a shortages of notes. I'm going to repeat that. It's a system based on scarcity. We're back to conflict and scarcity. It's how it's designed. It's ingenious if you're at top for a while. You can balance the books and make it work for a while, but in the end, the amount of interest on the notes will always far exceed the number of notes in circulation. One of the interesting phenomenons right now in the U.S. economy is that we have all these mixed bags of wild whiffs of what people believe to be inflation and wild whiffs of deflation. One of the typical things that happens to these private central banks is before they suffer a rapid inflation, which is what most people expect will happen someday in the U.S., in fact, they've been predicting this my whole entire life, that we're going to experience rapid inflation because of the money supply. But what's interesting, they don't understand the design of a private central bank in general. What happens is it's like a big balloon, and the air in the balloon becomes a money supply, and the hole in the balloon becomes the interest on the money supply. Well, the hole is going to always outpace the amount of air. And so what they're doing right now in the United States is they're not printing money. They're shoving liquidity in the system. They're shoving air into the balloon. The problem is that the hole in the balloon is so big that the air is escaping. So it doesn't matter how big the money supply is, the interest on the debt is always going to escape it, always going to outpace it. It doesn't matter how you shove in liquidity, its days are numbered. Right now, they're starting to buy our own debt, which is the last step. It's a pretty radical step that the Federal Reserve is taking, but it's the last step in what we will call the biggest private central bank they've ever pulled off. But you can get into it. Dr. Joseph P. Farrell has talked about it. He talks about it in a much better, much easier to understand, he's much easier to understand than yours truly. I just know what it means for us. There are two times in history where Europeans have not had private central banks, other than in ancient times. Ancient Sparta did not have a private central bank. They had a public central bank, and that's what they say the big war with Athens was over. After that, they did have a private central bank. But the ancient bullion brokers. And he talks about this class that are modern day banksters, and their ancient connections. But in a modern sense, it seems to run its course. In a modern sense, the Federal Reserve has a lot more tricks than the ancient bullion brokers, or even in the bullion brokers for the Bank of England. You see, bullion, it doesn't matter. You always get in this argument about the gold standard and all that stuff like that. Well, right now, you know, people, the bigger misunderstanding for many of you economists is nothing backs the dollar. Nothing behind the dollar. Well, that's not true. The dollar's not called a petrodollar for no reason. All the commodities in the world are priced in dollars. It's kind of one of their last and ingenious moves in doing that, because it allows them a great deal of leeway. You see, one of the challenges with the gold standard was that once again you have a private central bank loaning gold, and they're loaning gold back to the state and issuing that as a currency. They're issuing that as really what is called a facsimile of a currency. It's a false currency. They're loaning gold, basically. The problem is that the interest on the gold is always going to outpace the amount of gold in circulation. Again, a private bank in general cannot do anything about the interest. It has no way to deal with the interest. It can only loan the principal, and that's by design. They get someone deep in debt that way very quickly. But anyways, when it comes to gold, you're dealing with a natural resources that they're connected to directly. When you're dealing with a petrodollar, you're dealing with the natural resources connected through paper. It's kind of interesting. It's an indirect. They have a lender of last resort, as Soros calls it. The gold standard had no lender of last resort. If things get out of whack, they can't just print gold real quick. But this way, it allows them best of both worlds. They have a dollar backed by every commodity in the world, and if they don't, and if you want to change that, they're going to go to war with you. And of course, the big one's oil. That's why they're called petrodollars. But it allows them some leeway to be a lender of last resort. If something goes wrong, they don't have to worry about replacing the gold quickly or anything like that. But it's still the basic same mindset. It's backwards. There's two times in European history where we've thrown it off in modern times. One is very famous. It's the founding fathers of America. They were issuing colonial script. And colonial script is interesting because what is it? Well, it's a true currency. They're issuing currency against the full faith and productive capacity of the people. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be wooden nickels. That's all myth. You can't issue paper money. You can issue anything as long as it's a state central bank, as long as it's a real central bank, a public central bank. But they were issuing colonial script. They were issuing a true currency, and it was 0% interest. Everything balanced out. Well, the colonies were doing unreal. They were doing very, very well. And then you have the big crackdown over taxation without representation, and there's a handful of other factors in it. But most believe that it was basically due to the fact that they had a public central bank, that the Bank of England wasn't involved. And this has been a havoc in our history. They've used this to control basically our development. We were doing very, very well. Most people think that the colonies weren't doing well prior to the American Revolution. Well, they were doing extremely well prior to the crackdown. They were almost at full employment. We have a modern example. The modern example is called the German Miracle. The Adolf Hitler was reading a book by a man named Fader, F-A-D-E-R. I've never read the book, but the book talks about what Americans were doing prior to the American Revolution. And basically, that's what his premise for the Germany's debt problem and everything else was: just throw out the private central banks, throw out the Rothschilds and Rockefellers, throw out the cronies from the Bank of England and Wall Street and whatnot. And that's what Hitler did. Hitler issued Reichsmarks, and he had a whole big process he went through to do it. But it was pretty short. It was pretty clean. And within 36 months, well, it was a German miracle. All debt was paid off. You see, he's issuing money debt free. And what we do is we sit around and our race has been sitting around under this particular economic scheme, and we're turning gold into copper. Well, what he turned around and did, he did what the American founding fathers did, was he turned copper into gold. It's like a negative alchemy that they have us under. It's a drag. It just drags everything down, and everything's based on scarcity. Even in an ideal situation in America in the 1950s, which would be an ideal racially in most places, in America in 1950 were very, very white. But still, the economic system has always held our race back compared to what we saw prior to the American Revolution, especially what you see in Germany. There's also another modern example of a state central bank, the Bank of China. It's the largest state central bank we've seen, and they are issuing a true currency. Again, they're issuing currency debt-free. They're not paying a private central bank to do it. Why should you pay interest to a private central bank? Why should you get in this debt scheme? It's an interesting, but we're going to talk about where they come from, where they got going. And Joseph Farrell, in his book Babylon Banksters, he starts naming some of the families. He goes into where it comes from, where this stuff originated, where modern banking comes into play. We don't know everything there is to know about Babylon, other than a group got it going. There are those that believe they were related to these Pharisees. We'll go into that. We'll go into some speculation, because it's ripe for speculation. We know that this type of thing came into Egypt, this type of banking. We know it came into ancient Greece to some extent. And we know especially in the modern sense, all these families, these famous families from Rockefeller and Rothschilds are connected to what came out of Rome, the black nobility. And we're going to go into them first, then I'm going to talk about the Pharisees. We're going to talk about the Decepticons among us, the Elitesters, because they all look just like us. They all look very, very Aryan. And then we're going to talk about, and then last we're going to talk about the Jew Rabbits. I'm going to get you with some information on the Jew Rabbits. But let's go into Babylon Banksters, and we're going to talk about the racial composition of Rome, because Dr. Farrell comes out with it. He comes out with the latest research on some interesting stuff from Rome. And I'm going to read to you directly from the book, and we're going to start at page 268. So if you haven't read from Babylon Banksters, there's a few pages I'm going to read to you because it's that good. It's that good. He talks about the racial composition of Rome and a famous historian named Professor Tenney Frank. And what they're doing is they're putting together the Roman populations based on first names, second names, and third names. And you're using terms like prenomen or prenomen. Prenomen, and that's basically the first or personal name of a Roman citizen, such as Gaius Julius Caesar. But the big one's the cognomen, and the cognomen was apparently it started as a nickname, but it basically was a third name of a citizen of ancient Rome under Roman naming conventions. And we're dealing with those as a concept, and so you need to understand that. Prenomen and cognomen. We're basically talking about first, second, third names. And what they're doing is putting together the population based on these names, and it's rather interesting. Let me start reading this to you. Professor Tenney Frank was a professor at Johns Hopkins University at the turn of the last century and was the author of a well-known treatise, An Economic History of Rome. This work became such a standard in the field that it became the basis for entries in the Cambridge Ancient History and Oxford History of Rome. In the course of his researches, Professor Frank discovered an interesting thing about the population of ancient Rome during the period between the Republic and the final emergence of empire, and that is that the population was not Roman or Latin at all, but in a word, and without much exaggeration, Babylonian. In an article written for the American Historical Review, Frank begins by noting how the problem of ancient Roman race came to his attention. Visiting the ancient tombs of Rome, Frank observes that the historian will notice a curious and even a peculiar thing. And he quotes from Frank's epic work. He finds prenomen and nomen promising enough, but the cognomena, which is a third name, all seem awry. And he talks about Lucretius Pamphilius and Aemilius Alexa, Claudius Philostegus do not smack of freshman Latin, and he will not readily find in Roman writers such extent an answer to the questions that these inscriptions invariably raise. Do these names imply that the Roman stock was completely changed after Cicero's day, and was the satirist Juvenal recording the fact when he wailed that the Tiber had captured the waters of the Syrian Orontes? If so, are these foreign ordinary immigrants, or did Rome become a nation of ex-slaves and their offspring? Frank's tentative answers are even more unsettling than the original questions he asked. Studying almost 14,000 names, Professor Frank discovered that between 300 BC and 300 AD, the population of Italian Rome underwent a drastic change in ethnicity, such that by the end of this period, the vast majority of the Italian Roman population had Greek surnames and not Latin at all. For reasons which will presently appear, I have accepted, and this is him quoting Frank again, I have accepted the Greek cognomen, which is a third name, as a true indication of recent foreign extraction. And since the citizens of native stock did not as a rule unite in marriage with freemen, a Greek cognomen in a child or in a parent is sufficient status, i.e. was foreign. Professor Frank quickly dispatches the idea that this was simply due to the popularity craze of certain names, which is what they push now, by the way. On the other hand, the question has been raised, and this is Frank quoting, he's quoting Frank again, the question has been raised of whether a man with a Greek cognomen, which is a third name, must invariably be a foreign stock. Could it not be that Greek names became so popular that, like biblical and classical names today, they were accepted by the Romans of native stock? In the last days of empire, this may have been the case, but the inscriptions prove that Greek cognomen was not in good repute. I have tested this matter by classifying all the instances in the 13,900 inscriptions where the names of both father and son appear. That fathers with Greek names are very prone to give Latin names to their children, whereas the reverse is not true. Thus, the conclusion for Professor Frank was rather obvious. Clearly, the Greek name was considered a sign of dubious origin among the Roman plebeians, and the freedman family that rose to any social ambitions made short shrift of it. For these reasons, therefore, I consider the presence of Greek name in immediately family is good evidence that the subject of the inscriptions is of servile or foreign stock. The conclusion of our pros and cons must be that nearly 90% of the Roman-born folk represented in above mentioned sepulchre or burial inscriptions are of foreign extraction. I'm going to read that again. The conclusion of our pros and cons must be that nearly 90% of the Roman-born folk represented in the above-mentioned grave inscriptions are of foreign extraction. And let's go on and read. But this posed a rather large problem, and to see what it is and how Professor Frank dealt with it, we need to recall a bit of obvious history. The problem is that the mere presence of Greek surname on tomb inscriptions does not necessarily mean the occupant is Greek. The simple reason for this is that after Alexander the Great's conquest of Mesopotamia, Persia, and Egypt, the Greek language spread far and wide and became something of an international language, much as English or French today. Thus, a Greek surname on a tomb does not necessarily mean imply that all these Roman tombs had Greek occupants. But this raises a far larger and more significant question. If they were not necessarily Greek, then what were they? And what was the predominant ethnic stock they represented? Frank minces no words. Who are these Romans of the new type? And whence do they come? How many are immigrants? And how many of these of a servile extraction, slave extraction? Of what race are they? Frank's method of dealing with this question is to take Romans' classical authors and satirists at their word. And from this, an important and very significant fact emerges, noting that the most of the sociological and political data of the empire are provided by satirists. Frank then reasons himself to a rather astonishing conclusion. And then he quotes Frank again, and this is one of the more interesting things he quotes. When Tacitus informs us that in Nero's day a great many of Rome's senators and knights were descendants of slaves and that the native stock had dwindled to surprisingly small proportions, we are not sure whether or not to take it as an exaggerated thrust by an indignant Roman of the old stock to discover some new light upon these fundamental questions of Roman history. I have tried to gather such fragmentary data as the corpus of inscriptions might afford. The evidence is never decisive in its purport, and it is always by very nature of the material partial in its scope, but at any rate it may help us interpret our literary sources to some extent. It has at least convinced me that Juvenal and Tacitus were not exaggerating. It is probably that these men wrote a very small percentage of the free plebeians on the streets of Rome could prove unmixed Italian descent. By far the larger part, perhaps 90%, had Oriental blood in their veins. They were from the Middle East. They were from these mixed populations. One has only to read a bit between the lines to see what Professor Frank is implying. For Juvenal, let it be recalled that complained of Syrian Orontes, river flowing into the Tiber, a metaphor for the people of Chaldean or Babylon extraction having flowed in the bloodlines of the ancient Roman stock. These dregs called themselves Greek, he complains. I'm going to repeat that. These dregs call themselves Greeks, he complains. But how a small portion is from Greece and the river Orontes has long flowed into the Tiber. And this is a Syrian river, and I have no idea if I'm pronouncing it correctly, because I can't find the correct pronunciation, but it's O-R-A-N-T-E-S. It is a river, of course, that runs through Syria and Middle East. The basic historical outlines are now clear, for as Roman conquest spread into the eastern Mediterranean and eventually conquered the old Seleucid Empire, that's S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D, i.e. the proportion of Alexander's empire based in Mesopotamia with its capital of Babylon, many of these people made their way back to the Italian peninsula as slaves, and following the relatively lenient Roman custom of manumission of slaves upon the death of their owner, these later became freemen and the backbone of the Roman economy in the very lap of the empire itself. This brings us to the economics and finance part of the story. The part is, for our purposes, the most significant part. There are other questions that enter in the problem of the change of race of Rome, for the solution of which it is even more difficult to obtain statistics. For instance, one asks, without hope of sufficient answer, why the native stock did not better hold its own. Yet there are at hand not a few reasons. We know, for instance, that when Italy had been devastated by Hannibal and a large part of its population put to the sword, immense bodies of slaves were brought up in the east to fill the void, and that during the 2nd century BC, when the plantation system with its slave service was coming into vogue, the natives were pushed out of the small farms and many disappeared to the province of the ever-expanding empire. They basically went to other parts of Europe. Thus, during the 30 years before Tiberius Gracchus, the census statistics show no increase. During the 1st century BC, the importation of captives and slaves continued, while the freeborn citizens were being wasted in social, sullen, and civil wars. Augustus affirms that he had 500,000 citizens under arms, 1/8 of Rome's citizens, and at that, the most vigorous part. During the early empire, 20 to 30 legions, drawn, of course, from the best free stock, spent their 20 years of vigor in garrison duty, while the slaves, exempt from such services, lived at home and increased in numbers. In other words, the native stock was supported by less than the normal birth rate, whereas the stock of foreign extraction had not only been fairly normal birth rate, but a liberal quota of manumissions to its advantage. I'm going to interject here. What we're seeing in modern-day America is what they're trying to do is basically the same entire thing. And this same, when you're dealing with the Anglo elite, you're dealing with the same exact group. You're dealing with Rothschild and Rockefellers who come from this extraction. And we'll continue reading. The result of this combination of bad policy wars and heavily reliance on slaves was the original Roman race, at least on the Italian peninsula, went under. However, there were two significant things that the importation of Mesopotamian slaves accomplished. First, these slaves brought with them, of course, their culture and religion. Secondly, they brought with them their Babylonian business and banking practices. Thus, even when this population were slaves, the great majority of the normal, practical, day-to-day commerce of Rome, farming, construction, instruction, and so on, was conducted by slaves. And when freed, not only did their religion and culture penetrate Roman society to a significant degree, but this group gradually penetrates the highest reaches of Roman imperial government itself. The result, in short, was that the Mesopotamian and Syrian merchants effectively colonized Rome's provinces bordering the Mediterranean Sea. Roman banking was all but monopolized in their hands as the influence of Mesopotamian mystery cults extended throughout the empire. And that's where Talmudism comes in. And the activities of the temple continued to be associated with commerce. You remember in the New Testament we have with Jesus kicking the money changers out of the temple. This is precisely the type of thing they were talking about. The Babylonian the different banking clans, and in particular the Pharisees. In a certain limited sense, then, the Roman Empire may be viewed as but the least imperial front for the ancient class of bullion brokers. And that's what he calls them. Joseph Farrow calls them bullion brokers. They're modern-day private central bankers. And this change of ethnic stock in the heart of empire, the Italian peninsula itself, finally, explains why the bullion exchange policies of Rome vis-à-vis the Far East appear to be the product of deliberate manipulation. He goes on to talk about this, and we're going to move it up into modern times, into what Benjamin Disraeli says. And I'm going to read for you another page and a half, and then we're going to talk some more. Because there are some things we don't know. But we're looking at a direction here, and we're looking for the truth. And there's three varieties of Pink Rabbit. The banksters are interesting, because what we're reading about is how they got going. They were a slave class that started taking over. Not just a slave class, a servant class, we could say, that became free men. And they hooked up with another group. And they hooked up with this group through the religion they controlled. And so that's where the Leitsters come in. I've been asked if I think the Leitsters descend from these Pharisees that controlled Talmudism. I'd be willing to bet. They come out of Babylon, or they came out of Babylon long, long prior. And this is some of the population, the dregs left over. But we're going to continue talking about it. And this makes up what we think of as a black nobility. We'll continue reading this. And the next stage is Venice and banking, because this is interesting in itself. It talks about the fall of Rome and where these banksters moved to. The next stage, Venice and banking. A quick glance at the subsequent history of this class, and he calls him a class that happens to be all inbred and related. I would take Joseph P. Farrell to task on that. If you have a class of individuals that's all intermarried and all related, you're not dealing with a class, maybe some type of subrace or something, but they're a class that acts like a race on their own. But he calls them a class because they are all mixed up and they can go at it from time to time, I guess. But he keeps talking about the banksters and how the banksters came in. A quick glance at the subsequent history of this class will show that the connections to modern time for the next stage in the connective history was provided by Attila the Hun, who, ravaging the Italian peninsula and even Rome itself, forced many of these mercantile families to flee northward to the protective lagoons and marshes of what would later become the Middle Ages center of commerce and banking in Western Europe, Venice. In the early 9th century, Venice was formally recognized as part of the Eastern Roman Empire and thus began its rise as a financial power, for it was granted special trading and tax exemptions throughout the empire. Interesting. But the pattern, a mercantile and banking class operating behind special imperial privileges, remained the same. As noted in Chapter 4, however, the Fourth Crusade eventually captured Constantinople, and with that, the empire's monopoly on the right to coin gold was broken, and the Western European monarchs began to coin such money. But it was Venice that had funded the mercantile army of the French kings that captured Constantinople, and it was the Venetian Doge, Enrico Dandolo, that imposed the puppet Latin government on the ancient Eastern Empire. By this point, the great Venetian oligarchical families and their family fondi, which literally means fortunes, or literally funds, were in place. The Canaro, the Dandolo, the Catarini, the Morosini, the Sorzi, and the Tron fortunes. And then on 3, he goes on Amsterdam, London, the Reformation, and the Wars of Religion. Researcher Webster Tarpley, in three short paragraphs, outlines the connection of the Venetian banking and politics and subsequent European history during the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation and the period up to the English Glorious Revolution. And this is basically, remember that that Cromwell was funded by the by a banking group out of Europe, and they were by and large all what we think of as Jewish modern sense. And he's basically quoting Webster Tarpley, and I'm going to read from you this. Why are the British liberal imperialists called the Venetian Party? Well, for one, they call themselves the Venetian Party. The future Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli will write in his novel Coningsby, that the Whig aristocrats of 1688 wanted to establish in England a high aristocratic republic on the model of Venice, making the kings into doges, and with a Venetian constitution. In other words, the kings are just stoolies that sit up at top. During the War of the League of Cambria of 1509-17, an alliance of virtually every power in Europe threatened to wipe out the Venetian oligarchy. The Venetians knew that France or Spain could crush them like so many flies. The Venetians responded by launching the Protestant Reformation with three proto-stooges, Luther, Calvin, and Henry VIII. At the same time, Cardinal Contarini and his Jesuits made Aristotle a central component of the Catholic Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent, and put Dante and Piccolomini on the index of prohibited books. The result was a century and a half of wars of religion and a little dark age, culminating in the great crisis of the 17th century. Venice was a cancer consciously planning its own metastasis. From their lagoon, the Venetians chose a swamp and an island facing the North Atlantic, Holland and the British Isles. Here, the hegemonic Giovanni party would relocate their family fortunes, their fondi, and their characteristic epistemology. France was also colonized, but the main bets were placed further north. First, Cardinal Contarini's relatives and neighbor Francesco Zorzi was sent to serve as a sex advisor to Henry VIII, whose raging libido would be the key to the Venetian hopes. Zorzi brought Rosicrucian mysticism and Freemasonry to a land that Venetian bankers had been looting for centuries. He's talking about bringing them back into the British Isles, which, of course, they were already there before in Rome. Reading between the lines, one notes again the familiar and shadowy pattern of an ancient bullion broker's alliance with the temple, in this case the temple of the Renaissance Catholicism and nascent Protestantism, for one and the same financial powers behind both, and manipulating a conflict for its own profit. More importantly, the one notes another sinister and familiar pattern, that of David Rockefeller's Republic of Global Elites of Intellectual and Bankers at the Apex Pyramid of Power. And what he goes, and basically that's what he, you know, his entire point is tracing the evolution of this modern day private central bankers and where it came into Rome, and the black nobility and the naming of the families, and how they came into the British Isles, and it's pretty fascinating. And he talks about what the Rothschilds say about their genealogy, and I'm going to talk about that in the end because I've been asked directly about that. That they say they're related to the biblical Nimrod, but that could be one of two people, and I think it's a lie personally. But we'll go into that in the end. But one thing to note here is how they come in and what they're up to today. They're up to a new world order, and their new order is based on blended humanity, because at the basis they're chimerical. What's interesting is they held on to their religion by and large, Talmudism. And it is not known the full relationship. I do not know the full relationship between the banksters and the elitesters. I am guessing because we're seeing it right in front of our face of certain elements intermarrying. But I believe there are other elements that will never intermarry. For instance, we see the Clintons marry a little Jew rabbit, daughter marry a Jew rabbit. But it is not well known. Well, we don't know anything about the Clintons' genealogy other than Hillary's related to the Queen. And the Queen, of course, is... The Queen of England has presided over the largest attempted genocide ever. She's a Queen of England. She's a big brouhaha of Europe. She's a European royalty, the head of European royalty and all this stuff like that. And she's basically treated the average English child in the past 30 years, she's treated them lower than dirt because no one's ever tried to replace dirt. She's tried to replace us. We're considered a colony of them and yada, yada, yada. You get into this this royal brouhaha, but she's basically presided over all this. And when you go out and talk about the royal families, and this goes back a long ways, we don't know enough about their origins. But we are putting together their banker class. And their banker class, most people assume that the Rothschilds and Rockefellers, they have the queen in her hands and everything else. I think you'll find out that certain elements of royalty that they answer to them, not the other way around. It has always been, whether it be the Jew on the street, what we'll call the pink rabbit on the street, the Jew in the ghetto, or their banking class. Their banking class always funds a revolutionary class, which can come out of anywhere. But it is always thought that they had control of European royalty. But in fact, what we're witnessing come to fruition right now is a new world order, is where royalty is on the top post-World War II and tries to destroy our population. Yeah, Queen Elizabeth was in power when Winston Churchill was alive, and we've seen her try to outright destroy European children, or not say anything to the difference, which is kind of not say anything about it at all. So it's kind of mystery. You know, does one answer to the other? Or who answers to who? Well, when it comes to Masonic and fraternities and stuff like that, it is widely known that they all answer to the Queen. Yeah, she has a lot more power than we think. And it's, you get into these different theories that were known as conspiracy theories, and by and large, some of them may be true. You know, we don't know. We can only put together the pieces. I divide it up so we can discuss things formally, because the banksters came out of Rome. They're a mixed class that came out of Rome that by and large look European now, but they don't act European. They don't have our interests in mind. The royalty that's aligned with them certainly don't have our interests in mind. That's right in front of our face. At least most of them don't. What's interesting about this is that we don't know, are these elitesters all related to the Pharisees who were running Talmudism? Were they Decepticons in our midst going back to Babylon? Were they in our midst in ancient India and we just didn't know it? We don't know that. We don't know that. But what we're witnessing is mass treason. I always assumed, when first started looking at this, I always assumed it was always just the Jews. And that's got me in some trouble because certain researchers, the group's a little bit broader than you think. Generally speaking, when I see George Bush walking down the street with a yarmulke on and the Talmud going to his Talmud classes, I assume that he's a stupid goy going to talk to the Jews. Well, I believe now that it may be just the other way around. That he's from the old Pharisee class, and in fact, they've given them the religion, not the other way around. In other words, you have Talmudism, you have this bankster class that likes this religion, they practice this religion that was one-third of Rome was practicing this religion. It was a slightly different religion than now. Basically, the root doctrine are the Talmud, and no one's ever seen the full thing. The people running that are Pharisees, and the Pharisees basically wiped out all their competition. That's what we know to be true, because none of them ever survived. You know, we don't know anything about these guys, other than the obvious. They've tried to wipe us out, this whole entire group. You know, you call them a class, but they are related. You know, Hillary's related to the Queen. You know, what are these people all about? And we're still asking this question. The big one that you get into is the Jews and what race they are, because, you know, I take a lot of heat. You know, Horace, why don't you just say the pink rabbits are Jews? Because they're not all Jews in the sense that we think of as Jews. You know, I mean, you're dealing with the fact of a religion. You got to break down where it came from. You got to break down their documents, their symbols. Their symbol they use, a star of Saturn. The symbols that the little crazy Jews think is a star of David, is a star of Saturn. It's out of Babylon. They've used this stuff since Babylon. And I believe that there's something to the fact that you get into alternative news researchers that say the Jews are just a front group. Well, they're not just a front group because they're pretty active. they're pretty active. But I do believe that they're carrying around a religion that was given to them, and I do believe that that they wage war by deception in so much that there's, if you will, group within a group. And that's what the good alternative news and researchers would say. What we would think of as conspiracies, that the Jews are a front group, but you can't really say they're just a front group because their elites are so active, but that they're a race within a race of some extent at all. And it goes back to a deal between this bankster class and the Pharisees, who all practice Talmudism. And these Pharisees were extremely powerful. And there is a great deal of mystery. So I lay it out in three different distinct lines. And I know damn well that the elitesters look just like us. Rockefeller looks just like us. Rothschilds are known to be Jewish, but some elements of the Rothschild families are Catholic. It becomes, you're dealing with all mystery religions. And so the things behind it can become a mystery. They don't call it mystery religion for nothing. One of the interesting things that I get into from the alternative news and researchers in saying that the Jews are just a front group, they'll say, well, they don't really have any power. That's true, but they carry out orders. I don't believe the average rabbi has power, but he definitely carries out the order. You know, you're supposed to do what the rabbis tell you to do, and the rabbis basically all belong to different types of basically Jewish or Masonic fraternities of some extent, and that's a big word in itself. And they carry out whatever's passed down. You know, they're always promoting stuff. If immigration's the key, they're promoting it. But the big key is to understand what old Bob Whitaker said, is that one-third of Rome is Talmudic by conversion, or Jewish by conversion. And when you get into the Josephus Flavius, or Titus Flavius Josephus, who's considered a Roman Jewish historian, I don't know that he's Jewish in the traditional sense. You're not dealing with the same group at all. In other words, A. Foxy Foxman wasn't there yet. A. Foxy Foxman, those Jews out of Eastern Europe are just converts. And we're going to talk about them next because some interesting things have come out on them. But if you're looking, if you're listening to me and you're not a traditional, from the traditional racial audience that has read, that has read Jew Watch, or that has read Dr. David Duke's book, Jewish Supremacism. And there are many other authors that have said what David Duke has said historically. Dr. Duke's book is a very, very modern, with his quotes. If you haven't read the Dr. Kevin McDonald's, forget about his theory. I'm talking about the quotes from the Jewish elites themselves. If you haven't read those books, I would encourage you to do so. And forget about the theories. Look at their own quotes. But there is a YouTube video, and the YouTube video is now on my Twitter. And the YouTube video has a Jewish lady, and it's only a minute long, and you can watch it. Jews will play a leading role in multicultural Europe, says Jewish researcher. And you can look at the lady. The lady is an American citizen who lived in Israel, who's now living in Sweden, and trying to make them multicultural, multiracial. And she says they're going to be hated for what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. You know, maybe the average rabbi doesn't, but this lady does. And you're going to get an example of why the Dr. Kevin McDonald's, all the big hoopla over the Jews, and you're going to get the why there's such a book of Jewish supremacism. If some Europeans writing a book like Jewish Supremacism, if there's a site like Jew Watch, if this is all they talk about in Stormfront, if the indigenous white rabbits of Europe are ticked off at you, you've done something wrong, because it's very difficult to get us upset. I'm fully convinced of that. We're too nice. But you can watch the video. It's a minute long, and you'll see exactly what we're talking about. You'll see white rabbit genocide. And they are a very active front group who is very, very, it would definitely, in any tribunal, their elites would be first in line. But we're going to talk about them next, because the biggest addition to Talmudism, to modern-day Judaism, comes out of Eastern Europe. They come out of Eastern Europe, by and large, and they pushed into Eastern Europe. And we're going to talk about genetics, because this stuff is only a couple months old. And we're going to get into some pretty wild stuff here. But I'm going to take it from a little bit different angle. But there's three different groups. I can pin down Babylon, Egypt, the Hyksos. I can pin down and talk about the Pharisees, or talk about Talmudism in Rome. We can talk about the banksters. We know who they are. But when it comes to the elitesters, how this started, what's all behind them, well, they wage war by deception. And no one that wages war by deception, successfully as they have been over the hundreds and hundreds of years, we haven't seen all their cards yet. But I think someone has a pretty good beat on them. Yeah, someone has a pretty good beat on them, because they don't have their New World Order, and they should have had it long, long ago with their type of power. So we're going to talk about the Jews of Eastern Europe, and the, by and large, the big bulk of what we think of as European Jewry, where they come from. They are a mixed bag. They're Asiatic. They're part this, part that. Some of them look just like us, because, you know, during ancient Europe, you could be a Protestant or you could be a Catholic. You would have to be one or the other in any given country, but in any given country, you could be a Jew. So you could always, if you didn't like, Catholicism, you could just say, forget it, I'm not going to be a Catholic, I'm going to be a Jew. You know, I'm a Protestant, but I can't be, I'm moving to this country, but I don't want to be a Catholic so I can be a Jew. Now, very, very rare that that happened, but it did happen. And you do have people coming and people going into Judaism, like any religion. Yeah, you have people coming through marriage, people leaving through marriage, but by and large, there's a core group, and that core group has genetically stayed together. In fact, they have a genetic identifier. If you're moving to Israel, they can identify you as a Jew genetically. They have some little genetic identifier that they believe they got from their God. But we're going to talk about this core group that is intermarried, interbred, that what we think of now as the Jews, the Abe Foxy Foxmen, the ones out of Eastern Europe by and large, the ones that were running around Russia, the ones that the banksters, in my opinion, and the elitesters have used as a weapon. Because what we see an interesting pattern, and Dr. Kevin McDonald lays out a trend, and I like someone that lays out trends. He lays out the trend of the Jewish elite's behavior over and over again. It doesn't matter whether it's the neocons. It doesn't matter whether the Jewish elite's around at the French Revolution. It doesn't matter whether it's the Bolshevik Revolution. It doesn't matter whether it's pushing for war for Germany in World War II or World War I. They have a certain pattern of behavior, and that behavior pattern is fanaticism. It doesn't matter how nice your local rabbi is. He's never in power. And the ones in power have a particular trait. And that's one of the wonderful things about Dr. Kevin McDonald's book is it's more academic, and he points out this trait over and over again. And you can look him up online, and I'll actually link to a piece so you can read more about him and maybe buy some of his books, because you'd probably be interested. Even if you don't agree with his theory, look at the trend of the behavior of the elites, because the trend of the behavior, I believe, is genetic. And I'm going to say why. And if you look at the particular work, you're going to see very well researched. And if you just look at the quotes from the Jewish elites alone in Kevin McDonald's works or in Dr. David Duke's Jewish Supremacism, all you have to do is look at their quotes alone. All you have to do is watch the video on YouTube and do a little research. They are a very problematic group, and they've been used as a whole lot. But one thing that's interesting is basically what we see in front of our face is elements that are now in the Anglo banking elitester structure, using the Jews as a weapon against old European royalty. At the French Revolution, we have old European royalty losing their heads. In the Bolshevik Revolution, we have old European royalty getting killed. I think that's interesting. And we're going to talk about them and their behavior patterns, because they have this fanaticism that comes out in their elites. It doesn't matter how nice they are at the local level. Whoever gets in power are neocons. They're nuts. They got to have war at all fronts. We're going to talk about where it comes from. And what they believe. They believe they have a little gene from their God. And we're going to talk about this. And I'll be back with you, and we're going to talk about little Jew rabbits. One of the biggest challenges with talking about the Jew rabbits is there always is a lot of a lot of arguing over their origins, over this and over that, over how much power they have, how much power they don't have. By the time the Jew rabbits, any of us realize they have any power in any country, typically they're on their last days. They've been kicked out of pretty much every country they've ever been in, and the question is always why. Well, typically, you get into these conversations, and we go by what the Jews say. The Jews say they are their race, or they're this, or they're that, and you get a lot of, by and large, it started out that they were race, and now there's a lot of disagreement over that. You can't really argue about these things in public because you'll lose your job. So they're wielding a great deal of power, especially in the Anglosphere, and are allowed to. They certainly have a great deal of media power. And they have a great deal of, they tend to operate collectively, at least their elites do. Within that group, there's more and more disagreement these days. But we're going to go back, and I'm going to talk about one researcher that put out a particular theory. And its implications. And we're going to bring it up to date. I've been asked what I think about this individual and what I think about his research. And what I was not aware of is what came out on May 6, 2010 in Science Magazine. What I was, and then I'm going to take it out of the box again. I'm going to point out the obvious to you. I'm going to show you something in modern media, which is basically controlled by the Jew rabbits. Yeah, they do. Their elites have a great deal of media power. There's no point in hiding it. And when it was funny in Hollywood is people, when people come out and say the Jews own the media, then the own the media and have a great deal of power in the media. Then there's this big Jewish outrage, and then of course they got to come out and apologize for saying that. And say that the Jews don't own it. It's funny. They have so much power in the media that they can make someone apologize for saying they have power in media. It's very funny. But by and large, many of the contradictions and the problems they've created in the media, our legend. You can go to any site and research it. I haven't dwelt a great deal on them because they have so many different websites dealing with them. But if you go to the particular video I put up on YouTube about Jews will play a leading role in multiculturalism, you'll see the reason they are so disliked, at least from their elites. You also see the reason they're so distrusted. I would always distrust any European national group that puts a Jew in charge, because Jewish loyalty under their particular religion has to first be to the Jews. That's fine in Israel. Once you're outside of Israel, that creates a problem. That creates a big problem. And that's why they're by and large not trusted. There's nothing anyone can really do about it. It's just the way it is. So I would never trust anyone in any particular position of leadership. I don't really care who would come to an Amran conference, but as far as letting them run the thing, wouldn't be trusted. And I think there are many, many white men and women like that this day and time, and many other groups. Well, we're going to talk about a man named Michael Bradley. Michael Bradley was an out-of-the-box researcher who was considered rather eccentric, to say the least. And he wrote a book called The Iceman Inheritance. And it's labeled the most provocative book you'll ever read. And in it, he talks about basically Neanderthal genes. What's interesting about the book is how it first came out and what its implications were and the fact that he didn't even fully realize that. And I'm going to post a couple of his sites up, and you can read it for yourself. And I'm going to read from you his site, taking apart some of the different current statistics. Maybe many of you have seen all these television shows about Neanderthals breeding with Cro-Magnons. Maybe you've seen the Geico caveman and how cool he is. You know, that Geico caveman dating those blonde women, and he's cool. Maybe you've noticed, you ever watch Encino Man? Well, the debate is on over Neanderthals' genetic inheritance in modern-day humans. And the research has come out 1% to 4%. And we're going to back up and we're going to talk about the Iceman inheritance and what this means. And this is one of the more provocative discussions we're ever going to have, because I don't really touch on the Jew rabbits. I don't really, by the time you get a JewWatch.com, I consider them over with. But we're going to talk about it for a minute and what it has implications, the implications for World War III. And I'm going to take it out of the box and I'm going to point out something to you. And I'm going to read you right from his website, and these are up on my Twitters. This is one of his first, talking about how his book first came out. Ironically enough, The Iceman Inheritance was very favorably received after its initial Canadian publication, December 1978. And this is talking about, basically, the book is talking about how much Neanderthal is in modern-day human. Dr. Judith Posner, an anthropology professor at Toronto's New York University, had written in her introduction, "The Iceman Inheritance is a worthy model to keep in mind when reviewing the long range of human history, and especially when looking into the future." Several other anthropologists, sociologists, and historians were equally encouraging. All agreed that the argument of the Iceman inheritance was well worth an airing and objective assessment. The book was immediately excerpted by three major Canadian newspapers, the Globe and Mail, the Calgary Herald, and the Ottawa Journal. About 20 U.S. newspapers also excerpted it, or else wrote long and generally very favorable reviews. The book was seen as a new and valuable insight in the pattern of human history. There were some experts who disagreed with the theory, of course, but two observations were hard to shrug off. First, every single modern political boundary on Earth has been drawn or dictated by Caucasians. Second, I provided an anthropological map of Iceman's inheritance. It's talking about Neanderthal patterns of where they lived, which showed inexorable Caucasian expansion from 100,000 years ago to now. This made good TV graphic. I was interviewed by Tom Schneider on NBC's Coast to Coast Tomorrow television talk show. The other guest was Bill Cosby. While the book was being promoted at the annual convention of American Anthropological Association held in Los Angeles in 1979, I was invited to give multi-part presentation at Princeton University's Institute for Advanced Study Symposium on Alternative Futures. This was covered by CBC's radio's prestigious Ideal series. A major North American publisher, Warner Books, later Times Warners, bought the mass market paperback rights in late 1979 and quickly put out an edition that sold 40,000 copies in the first 2 weeks. Then in early 1981, someone figured out the implications for Jews in the book's presentation of evidence. I had never considered this myself because it had been a long time since I had taken my own Jewish origins into any account. I had never even thought about any Jewish implications of the book. Neither did the Jewish publisher of the original Canadian edition, Larry Goldstein, and obviously Dr. Judith Posner had not thought about any Jewish implications either when she wrote an introduction for The Iceman Inheritance, unless, of course, courageous Judy Posner simply had an affinity with all humanity other than her own ethnic group. Jews were blandly mentioned on half a page in the 226-page book. After 1981, some bookstores that had formerly carried the book were threatened with boycott and firebombing by Jewish pressure groups. Warnings by Jewish anthropologists and complaints by Jewish pressure groups called Warner Books to drop the book almost instantly in breach of contract. But my rights to find another publisher were not immediately returned to me, as is usually the case in such situations and is also the normal industry practice. Warner Books wanted to cooperate in the strategy of making The Iceman Inheritance totally unavailable to buyers and readers. Two speaking tours by the authors were canceled because the organizers could not guarantee my safety in view of threats of violence by the Jewish Defense League. The seriousness of the situation was demonstrated when Amir Kahani-inspired extremist tried to stab me on the podium at Kennedy King College in Chicago. To add insult to near, so much for free speech there. To add insult to near injury, I found that although The Iceman Inheritance was sufficiently provocative for the Jewish media mafia to suppress it, and also to steal it for profit when convenient, I was not to earn income from it. Because of the 1979 Anthropological Convention in Los Angeles and my appearance on NBC's Tomorrow Show, interview with Tom Schneider and co-guest Bill Cosby, two L.A. screenwriters heard the story. They were inspired to write a movie script called The Iceman about a frozen Neanderthal who, on being thawed out by a scientist, exhibited aggression and identity problems in the dimension of time. The two writers wrote me a letter in 81 thanking me a lot for their inspiration, but also for the book's technical and anthropology data that were able to include in their screenplay. I learned completely by accident a few months later that Canadian producer Norman Jewison had acquired the screenplay and planned to produce Iceman in 1983 at a cost of $11 million. At the time, I was otherwise engaged in the Caribbean trying to help mostly with my own money and some government assistance impoverished people in the third world. I was making inexpensive fishing boats and electricity producing windmills with the help of the Canadian International Development Agency. See the many articles, Hot Air and Ancient Wonders, on the site. Although Canadians swear by Jewison's so-called integrity and his encouragement of Canadian creators, none of this applied to me when I appealed politely to several letters to these noble qualities supposedly possessed by Norman Jewison. And when it didn't work, Jewison is his name, J-E-W-I-S-O-N. When it didn't work, I didn't have enough time or money to fight Jewison's expensive L.A.'s lawyers effectively. The upshot was that Jewison made the film, released in 83, and I received no money and not even screen credit for supplying the entire theme, not the plot, thankfully, of Jewison's The Iceman supplying most of the research. Banned by Jewish social and financial influence in the so-called mainstream, i.e. white American educational institutions, The Iceman Inheritance was partially suppressed. And also, of course, no major publisher would touch it because of legal complications in the Jewish opposition. But because of the stir caused by the approximately 200,000 Warner Books paperback that has been sold by 1981, the public's growing demand for the book was much greater than supply. This encouraged the production of at least four pirate editions based on Xerox copy of the Warner Books paperback and one pirate edition based on the original Canadian hardcover. These pirate editions dominated the market for a decade while focused on the third world aid and development projects. And that's typical white man, isn't it? He stumbles onto something potentially that could make him a fortune, even if he wanted to be provocative about it and print it in his own books. But he's in the third world helping out little brown people. Finally, because of the embarrassment caused by these editions, when the New York Times and Warner Brothers merged to become Times Warners, they wrote me a letter saying that they had no interest in the books. They denied that they had ever held rights to it and also denied that they had even published it. And so this is a very fascinating story about how a book, a white researcher stumbles onto something, about how much Neanderthal DNA in humanity may have, where this DNA is concentrated on the globe, because you've got 6 billion people on the planet, and inadvertently what it means. Yeah, because he didn't realize what it meant, neither did his publisher, what it could potentially mean if he were right, if his thesis was right. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to bring it forward. I'm going to put up this particular, this is one of his, about his original book, his original promo. I'm going to put this up. And you're also going to read his current, because now he's in big demand again. And I'm going to read you from his website because he says it much better than I could. And then we're going to discuss it. But he's on demand for some of the different talk shows all of a sudden. Well, what happened all of a sudden? Well, there's been a lot of speculation over Neanderthals and what they were like. And we're going to come back to this in a minute. But what basically happened is Science Magazine, and there was a study done on May 6, 2010, so it wasn't that long ago, just this year, basically vindicated the Iceman inheritance and the chosen people from the Caucasus. But beware of that 1 to 4% statistical spin. This is on a site now. Basically, he was right on a few things, at least scientifically, and you can argue to some extent one way or another, and we can do that. But let me read to you what he says, because maybe you're riding in the car, or maybe you don't want to get up on my Twitter, or maybe you don't want to read it for yourself. So I'm going to read it to you, because it's rather interesting. He's talking about the science, and this just happened in 2010. And he's talking about his old book that he published that caused so much of a big brouhaha and a storm, so much so that the book publisher denied they even published it, which is kind of fascinating in itself. Okay, let me start reading this. The May 6, 2010 issue of Science Journal of American Academy Sciences has finally confirmed the modern human populations have significant Neanderthal genetic admixture. This study by Max Planck Institute of Leipzig under the overall leadership of Drs. Vant Pabo, also included some researchers from the Harvard University School of Medicine. Behind the scenes, it seems that this DNA's dramatic reversal of the, what they're calling Pabo Stone King cell, article of July 15, 1997, insisting that there was no Neanderthal DNA in modern humans, was due to the fact that the Harvard researchers came up with the data that contradicted the 1997 study by Svante Pabo, then the University of Munich, and Mike Stone King, then at the University of Pennsylvania. Personally, I've always suspected that this 1997 study was purposely concocted or even commissioned to please North American Jews and to further Israeli interests. In the 1997 study, Svante Pabo and Mike Stone King claimed to have recreated part of the Neanderthal DNA sequence to an acceptable extent, 2%. And then to have to compare it to human DNA. But the complete human genome wasn't mapped until 2005. In short, Pabo and Stone King were comparing nothing much to nothing at all. Dr. Alan Templeton, a geneticist at American University in St. Louis, characterized their 1990 study as a statistical house of cards. You know, the whole genome wasn't known then. At the time, the acknowledged world expert on Neanderthals was Dr. Eric Trinkaus, formerly anthropology department at the University of New Mexico. His massive book, The Neanderthals, was published in 1992 by Random House. Trinkaus chose to adopt the new German spelling system, which hasn't caught on among Germans. The Neanderthals contain this observation in the concluding pages. Only humans from the Near East and parts of Europe can claim Neanderthals per se in their direct ancestry. Let me go into it. Only humans from the Near East and parts of Europe can claim Neanderthals per se in their direct ancestry. The 1997 Pabu Stone King study published in the July issue of Cell was highly promoted in North American media, contradicted Trinkaus, prevented Random House from issuing a cheaper mass market paper book edition of Neanderthals in the fall of 97 and immediately enthroned Svante Pabo instead of Eric Trinkaus as the world's leading expert on Neanderthals in the public mind. Naturally, the 1997 Pabo Stone King Cell article also discredited my own books, The Iceman Inheritance, 1978, and The Chosen People from the Caucasus, 1992, because I had concluded exactly what Trinkaus had concluded. Only I said it first. This new May 2010 study concedes that from 1 to 4% of modern human DNA is Neanderthal. However, I see and smell a little loophole just large enough for a statistical rat. The conclusion of this new 2010 study, certainly vetted and possibly written by Pabu, are clearly intended to convey the impression that this 1.4% of lingering Neanderthal DNA is more or less evenly distributed throughout the world except for Africa, where there's supposedly no Neanderthal DNA, and I find this hard to believe. The May 2010 study even found Neanderthal DNA in New Guinea, which is highly unlikely. And I wonder who the carefully chosen modern donor was to get this supposed Neanderthal DNA. I like to joke that it was probably the fictional Dr. Jacob Epstein, formerly a New York doctor who now practices in Port Moresby. That's the worldwide taboo spin on the Neanderthal DNA in modern humans. And looked at this way, 1 to 4% doesn't amount to much. Figures don't lie, but liars figure. On June 5th, 2010, the world's population was estimated to be 6.8 billion plus people, United States Census Bureau, Wikipedia. Basically, we're pushing on 6.8 billion right now. 1% of that is roughly 68 million and change. 4% works out to 278 million people. Odd, isn't it, that this is about the population of the Middle East, according to my Bloomsbury Pocket Atlas. And this is the geographic homeland of the Semitic peoples, the present Judeo-Islamic Arabs and the Jews. Work it out for yourself on any good atlas. Using maps and atlases, there is a way of looking at this 1 to 4% of Neanderthal DNA in modern humans that makes a great deal of historical sense. What if this Neanderthal DNA is concentrated in the Caucasus Middle East? And this is his thesis, basically, and I'm going to read it again. What if this Neanderthal DNA is concentrated in the Caucasus Middle East, where this 2010 study admits that Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons, or early modern humans, met and interbred? Surely it is reasonable to suppose that the main concentration of the world's surviving Neanderthal DNA must be in this area, discounting very modern migrations of some people by railroad, steamship, and aircraft transportation. And the Neanderthal DNA decreases rapidly as distances from the Caucasus center of interbreeding increases. Basically, modern human travel is just that, modern. The only ones that travel are known to travel a lot in ancient times, or guess who? Europeans, in my opinion. That's my two cents. Most of these populations in the Middle East have been there for a long time. There would be virtually no Neanderthal DNA in Atlantic Western Europe, but there would be more in Central Europe and much more in Eastern Europe, and especially in the mountainous regions. There would be virtually none northward toward the Baltic Sea, and certainly none east of Kazakhstan to the Pacific Near East, and we were already told that there was supposed to be no Neanderthal DNA in Africa. But actually, there should be at least some Neanderthal DNA in North Africa, because the Arab Muslims conquered it. Now, this sort of Neanderthal DNA distribution might average out to an insignificant 1 to 4% Neanderthal DNA in the whole world's population. See, as Mark Twain first put it, first come lies and then damn lies and statistics. Now, assuming this sort of concentration of Neanderthal DNA in the Caucasus Middle East, that 1 to 4% of the world population suddenly becomes very significant indeed. It means that Semitic peoples of Middle East, Jews, Arabs, and others, like Armenians, must therefore be substantially Neanderthal. And this sort of concentration of Neanderthal DNA seems to be the case. On May 10, 2010, and this stuff is just recent, a Svante Paabo co-researcher on the new study, Johannes Kraus, said on mid-German TV network that the people of the Middle East and Semites were at least from 10 to 20% Neanderthal. The internet link to this interview on the mid-German TV network was deactivated on May 18, 2010. I'm going to repeat what Kraus is saying. 10 to 20% Neanderthal. That's huge. This is precisely what I argued in the Iceman Inheritance in 1978 in The Chosen People from the Caucasus, and what Eric Trinkhaus at least interfered in his Neanderthals of 1992. However, my own calculations indicate that some Middle Eastern Semitic populations approach 50% Neanderthal, and in some very specific small areas, 70% Neanderthal. Given the usual modest Semitic populations of the mountain valleys and arid landscapes of the Caucasus Middle East, and the sort of Neanderthal DNA concentration among some groups would not affect that 1 to 4% of the total world population very much. In my view, there are two major subspecies of technical humanity, quote-unquote, presently contending for domination of our world. One subspecies and most influential one in terms of sheer number and geographic extent simply to be called ordinary humanity. Before 15th century European maritime expansion and commerce, they inhabited Atlantic, Western Europe, most of Africa, perhaps Atlantis in the past, North and South America, and across the Pacific to the Far East, Japan, and China. There are several geographic varieties of the subspecies differentiated by skin color and other physical traits, but this subspecies as a whole exhibit a clear tendency toward polytheism, a tolerance of females in society and divine affairs, and relatively low levels of aggression. All varieties share a reasonable level of intelligence, very definite visual arts ability, relatively non-protruding noses, and only moderate male hairiness. He goes into his theories, and I'm going to read them to you. Because of the differences in physical characteristics of this subspecies, it may be possible that it really consists of several subspecies that evolved separately in slightly different ways from their various geographic areas and different environments of origins. Basically, he's trying to say that because of race, there are differences because of race, or he's trying to do it in his own unique way. I don't think he's all that racially inclined. or it may have been originally been just one eastern or southern African subspecies that migrated in the varied geographic areas and then evolved unique characteristics. This latter is the modern view, but it may not be correct. However, the roughly common mentality of this subspecies, much more important than its superficial physical characteristics, indicates a relatively low degree of sexual dimorphism in its primal anthropological ancestry, except in areas where it has since been greatly affected biologically and culturally by expansion of other contending subspecies. As in Central and Western Europe, after the Jewish diaspora AD 70, the Hun invasion AD 451-453, the Khazar migration from the Russian-Ukrainian steppes into Central Europe of AD 1000-1300, this other contending subspecies originated in what I call the toxic lozenge, a narrowly elongated and lozenge is just simply area. A narrow, elongated area contending from the Rift Valley lakes of Tanzania, Kenya, and southern Ethiopia to the northern Caucasus Mountains. This toxic lozenge, therefore, encompasses the geographic epicenters of both Homo habilis and later Neanderthal development. This toxic lozenge is also original homeland of the Hamitic languages and later seemingly related Semitic ones. Note that ancient Egypt was well to the west of this toxic lozenge, crosses the Red Sea between Jeddah and Medina in Arab, and a now area called Hijaz, or Yemen, but known as Saba or biblical Sheba in ancient times. This very place where the first evidence of the Hebrew language has been discovered and where Islam is also later conceived. And he has a few theories on that, I guess, as well. Physically, this subspecies is characterized, and they're talking about the subspecies that's part Neanderthal. Physically, the subspecies is characterized by very great nasal development, extreme hairiness in males, long torso and short legs, extremely high numerical and spatial intelligence, very little visual artistic ability, a low level of emotional stability, fanatical monotheism, anti-feminism, predisposition to control or enslave or exterminate ordinary humanity. He's going into his theories. There is some anthropological evidence that this subspecies may derive from Homo habilis, though the Neanderthals and on to modern representatives. However, not all anthropologists agree that Homo habilis should be considered fully human, as that term is rather loosely defined, but possibly an aberrant offshoot of either Homo or Australopithecus. That is, people deriving from this toxic lozenge in ancient times may not be exactly human and certainly seem to be incompatible with the values and attitudes of normal humanity. However, recent historical migrations into this toxic lozenge represent mostly ordinary African. That's Africans coming to the north, basically. Much more important than physical traits, the aggression of this subspecies is responsible for its expansion from its original toxic lozenge from both east to west to inhabit most of the Middle East, especially the mountainous regions, and even some parts of Europe, especially Eastern Europe, Western India, Northern and Eastern Africa, imposing its religious and social values. In short, the people of this toxic lozenge have gradually driven a wedge of perhaps not quite human genes and a culture between the ordinary humanity of the West and ordinary humanity of the Far East, and this wedge has been inexorably expanded by the well-known historical events from 5600 BC to present. Despite the incessant propaganda and disinformation promulgated by the subspecies, adherence to Judaism, Judeo-Christianity, and Judeo-Islam are the symptomatic indications of this biological expansion and/or cultural influence. And he goes on to talk about this toxic lozenge subspecies is the most influential one in the terms of its high, extremely high aggression. See Hard Times Among the Neanderthals, Natural History Journal of American Museum of Natural History, New York, 1978, Dr. Eric Trinkhaus and Dr. Dale Stewart from Smithsonian. And he shows a picture of the Neanderthals on a toxic rampage and the toxic lozenge circa 50,000 BC. And they're pretty... And he talks about their aggressiveness. How aggressive are they? Trinkhaus and Stewart subjected every Neanderthal bone then known to forensic style analysis and found over twice the number of violence inflicted injuries among any similar number of bones from other fossil humans. The problem is that even on this one, by the way, I'm interjecting here, I've heard that Neanderthals are as much as five times more violent because what they're doing is putting all humans in one category. Africans tend to be a little more violent than Europeans, and Europeans tend to be a little more violent than East Asians, so it really depends on how you look at it. They're a hell of a lot more violent than us, so, and I'm going to get back to this point. Nonetheless, though extremely violent, Neanderthals took care of their injured and elderly people. See Trinkhaus and Stewart, see Ralph Selecki's later work by Shanidar Cave. Ironically, this Trinkhaus and Stewart article was published 1 month after the publication of Iceman Inheritance in November 1978. I could certainly have used this data if it would have been available a few months earlier. In other words, they were extremely violent. They were very much in-group, out-group. They took care of their elderly. They weren't stupid. We think these cavemen were stupid. That's what they're called. Neanderthals, caveman. We thought they were stupid, but they're not. They're not. They're not. They don't have any artistic ability. They wouldn't be able to build Western civilization, but they're not by any means stupid. This December 1978 Trinkhouse study and article adequately explains why the Middle East has been a region of chronic conflict for 3,500 years or more, or less reliably recorded human history. Very little more needs to be said or written about the extreme Middle Eastern aggression itself. However, much more can be said and written about how the Western world got drawn into the Middle East confrontations. And he goes on to talk about this, and I want everyone listening to this and ever heard of the Jew rabbis to go and read his theory. Look up the modern science. Look up the, one of the questions is always, Ben, are the Jew rabbis a race, or are they this, or are they that? Well, they say they're a race. They say they have a gene from their particular god. By the way, when the Hyksos came also out of this toxic lozenge. The Hyksos of ancient Egypt were believed to come from a mountainous region, were Asiatic, and they came in on a rampage. They exhibited a high level of aggression, and many of the traits we would think of as modern Jew rabbit or in some of these areas of the Middle East. But we're going to talk about this. I've been asked what I think about this because this is very new researcher. You can put out any theory you want, but when you start talking about German researchers saying 20% of the Middle East is elements of the Middle East have as much as 20% of Neanderthal genes. You know, you get these the Jewish migrations. The biggest group coming into Talmudism is the Eastern European Jewry, and they came in from the east. They came in from these regions, the Caucasus, the Khazars. This is all one big toxic region. We'll call it the toxic rabbit stew. And they have some of the prototypical Neanderthal traits, from the nose to the lips to the red hair. If you read the stuff, it's provocative. And so his book became provocative, and he didn't even know about it. He didn't even think about what he's putting out there. Neither the Jewish publishers. And so now you have a modern researcher on German TV saying, we estimate the Middle East to be 20% Neanderthal. What does that mean? What it means is there's a lot of infected rabbits. You know, when the Jews tell you that they have a separate god, they have a little gene related to them, they may be telling you the truth. They may know something you don't know. They're the largest addition to Talmudism. You got the pink rabbit banksters. You got the elitesters. I can point a finger in the direction of them. And we know a little bit about the banksters. Well, I don't know near as much about the elitesters as I like to, other than they look just like us. But then you have these little Jew rabbits, and they've been used as a weapon. One side of European royalty, let's call it the black nobility, those tied to the black nobility, the bankster class, all the nobility tied to the bankster class, has used this little weapon that's extremely aggressive against the other side. This is a fact. Their traits in leadership. Now, I'm not talking about your local rabbi. But if you read the Kevin McDonald's, you talk about their traits, the pattern of their traits, the trend of their traits from the Bolshevik Revolution, even to the right now, the neocons, or even to the French Revolution. Their pattern of behavior among their elites, or what rises to the top, is very, very similar from the Benjamin Netanyahu's, from their fanaticism. It's fascinating theory. We don't know because we don't know everything about their DNA, but I was asked what I think about this in light of this evidence, and I've never really talked about them. And if I'm going to talk about something, I'm going to point out something you've never seen before. But this is an interesting researcher that I didn't really take as seriously as maybe we should have. You never know when a white rabbit might be onto something. But what it would mean is major elements of the Middle East, major elements of the Caucasus, major elements that have exploded, their birth rates have exploded, major elements that come out of Eastern European Jewry would not be able to control their behavior. I mean, what you're talking about is a different species, something half Neanderthal, half human. What bothers me about this is not what the Bradleys are saying, because what bothers me about this is what our enemies are saying. And let's go into what's right in front of your face. There was a famous book, famous movie, that presented Neanderthals in pretty truthful. A Quest for Fire. It talks about Neanderthals and how violent they were. There's some interesting different pics of Neanderthals, of what they may or may not have looked like. And then, after post-1981, we see a trend, and this trend is right in front of our face. And let's back this up for listeners who aren't, who don't even know anything about the Jews, who are not really racially inclined. If you were to go and watch TV, which I'm sure most of you do. You'll notice that Africans are usually smart. They're usually witty. They're going to save the world. Will Smith is going to save the world. And they never commit any crime. They never really do anything wrong. You know, Black Rabbits is so sexy. Black Rabbits is so wonderful. But then I'd like you to do something. Most of you have observed that in the media. It's right in front of our face. I'd like you to do something. I'll go to Amren.com, Amren.com. And I want you to look up something, the color of crime. Now, the color of crime is not Amren statistics. They're FBI statistics. And I want you to compare FBI statistics in this study. And they make the old studies are available. It's not very expensive. You can find out all about it. You can get the breakdown on the statistics. They're FBI statistics. Compare the FBI statistics for African and American crime against non-Africans with what you see in the media. It's kind of a 180. You don't have to listen to them. You don't have to listen to white nationalists. All you got to do is look at the numbers. Most white rabbits can see the numbers. Most of you are already aware of it on a subconscious level. That's why you live in an all-white neighborhood, if you're lucky. But they tend to, they like being around their own, because most people do. Most rabbits do. But they can be a little bit different in reality than what's presented in Hollywood. Hollywood has a tendency to distort the truth. And the Jew rabbits pretty much run the Hollywood show. That's the division of labor. You know, you got the Jewish banksters who definitely are out in the forefront, the Rockefeller and Rothschilds. You've got the Jewish elites who are definitely out in the forefront. Those pink rabbits are definitely out in the forefront of Hollywood, and maybe even the law profession in America. There's quite a few doctors already, but by and large, the media, you can study the trend in the media on how they distort reality. And of course, you've never seen a Jew look bad on TV. It doesn't really happen. Anyone that says anything to the contrary is a Nazi who's going to kill 6 million Jews. Mel Gibson, they went fanatical. They went absolutely ballistic over his movie, The Passion of the Christ. Now, most white Christians saw the movie, wouldn't think any big deal, other than it's pretty violent. But they don't think in those terms. There may be a biological reason for that. They may not be able to control it. What has bothered me about the Iceman inheritance, what has bothered me about these links put up, is not what Bradley's saying, but what about a trend our enemy has put in place post, let's say, Encino Man. And I'm going to talk about a trend right in front of our face. Encino Man's a pattern of movies we've seen. We've seen a constant portrayal from Hollywood post 81 that the caveman, especially post 1990, that the caveman is wonderful, that the Neanderthals are pretty harmless, that they're just like us, only like, you know, hairy version of us. And one movie comes to mind, and there are several more. It's a far cry from A Quest for Fire. I haven't seen all of Quest for Fire, but I've seen enough on YouTube to know it was pretty honest portrayal. But we have two different camps here. One camp telling us the Neanderthals and the caveman were wonderful, just like us, you know, one of our brothers in humanity. And I'm going to read some recent news articles. We have another camp that says they were extremely violent, and the populations that would contain any amount of their genes would be extremely incompatible with the rest of humanity. And extremely, would have psychological problems, would have several other different problems that a hybrid would have. But one of the things that have always bothered me about the Iceman inheritance, this type of theory, is what our enemy does in the media when it comes to the caveman. Post 1981, specifically post 1999, post 1990, we've seen basically, the same pattern that they did with the black rabbits. You know, African rabbits is so wonderful. African rabbits is, God's, you know, so sexy and so wonderful, and they never do anything wrong, and they never commit any crime, and they're going to save the world. And we had this movie come out, Encino Man. You can look it up, E-N-C-I-N-O. And it's about a Neanderthal that thaws out. And it's a direct 180 from where this Neanderthal would act like. He looks just like us. He's very humanized. He's very nice. He's just like us, but he's just some caveman. You know, this is their portrayal of this in the media. And this is a sliding scale. And let me point out one recent example, one of the famous recent examples, and there are several of these. There are several of these. It's a 180 move. You know, you go from what the Africans really look like in the crime statistics to what Africans are really doing in Hollywood, and it's a 180. The world's upside down in Hollywood. And so now you have our enemy sitting in Hollywood, all of a sudden, overnight, portraying the caveman, the Neanderthals, as these wonderful, just like us, but a little hairier. And there's another one. It's very, very famous. It's the Geico caveman, and I'm going to put up his Wikipedia. The Geico caveman was brought out by Geico, and it's a famous television commercial. It's actually kind of funny, except when he's dating blondes and everything else. And you can watch him on YouTube. This is a major, it's copyrighted, Geico caveman. And this is a Neanderthal. He's humanized. He's a little bit hairier. Nowhere near as humanized as Encino Man, but he's a little hairier. His nose is a little more pronounced. He's not, by the way, he doesn't look anything like a real Neanderthal. But by and large, you get the picture. He's very humanized. He's very smart. He's very witty. He gets all the girls. He's the caveman, the Geico caveman. And they have been plugging this. And those are two good examples of a 180. In real life, Neanderthals or any hybrid would have serious problems. And we're seeing these problems right on the planet right now, potentially, is what Mr. Bradley's thesis and several others. But what we're seeing in Hollywood is the direct opposite. What we're seeing in Hollywood is the direct 180 flip from what the scientists are saying. The real scientists are saying Neanderthals would be extremely violent. They would not be stupid. They would have very good mathematical abilities, which I thought was wild. I thought they were just stupid cavemen. They wouldn't be able to have any artistic expression, really. They would have extreme difficulties in many areas of building society. But at the same time, they would operate under extreme in-group, out-group, extreme tribalism. And of course, they would have evolved. They would have had genes that evolved during an ice age. An ice age is all flight or flight response. It's all what? Conflict and scarcity. I mean, what's more scarce than ice age? You know, you're going to have to fight for everything. And many of these populations that are accused, or the Germans are talking about being up to 20% Neanderthal, well, they don't appear to be able to turn it off or control themselves. It's interesting. What's interesting about it is what is happening in Hollywood, what's happening in Anglosphere in regards to the conditioning, in regards to going on, what Neanderthals, what the caveman were like. And let's talk about some recent news pieces. Science news. Neanderthals more advanced than previously thought. They innovated, adapted like modern humans. And it talks about, and I'm going to put this up, and it's a complete spin. It is likely that Neanderthals were absorbed by modern humans. Well, it's known now that they were. My research suggests that they were a different kind of human, but human nonetheless. We are more brothers than distant cousins. Well, that's interesting. This is Japan Times, as quoted by the Washington Post, April 21st, 2002. Neanderthals were just like us, violent but caring. And he goes on to talk about how wonderful they are. And, you know, it's been a sliding scale, a sliding scale. Science News, this is 2008, a little more recent. New evidence debunks stupid Neanderthal myth. And it has an interesting picture. I'm not going to put these up, and I encourage you to do your own research. I encourage you to look up the Geico caveman. I encourage you to watch Encino Man. And there are dozens of these examples. They are making the Neanderthal look human from Hollywood. They're making the Neanderthal look smart, witty, and nonviolent. Well, he might have been smart. He may have been somewhat witty, but he's not nonviolent. And they wouldn't be compatible with us. It's a 180 flip from where science is talking about. It's kind of like the African in the media. The African in the media is not presented anywhere to the extent that it's presented in the FBI crime statistics. It's just not. It's far removed from reality. Our enemy has this pattern of behavior, removing things from reality. You're trying to flip things upside down. But this is something that's sliding right in front of us. So I was asked, what do I think about Michael Bradley? I don't know what the numbers are going to be, other than if 1.4% is Neanderthal, 1.4% of humanity, and we know that's concentrated in one area, that's a lot. That's a lot. That's a lot. And you have our enemy presenting over and over again as these... As the caveman, as the Neanderthals, as harmless heroes, you know, really cool guys to hang out with. They wouldn't be able to control anything. They would be gone. Gone mentally. Gone genetically. And extremely violent. And prone to violence. Once they got going, you couldn't stop them. Kind of like modern day neocons or something. Many of the traits they exhibit, you know, you can compare and contrast from many of the researchers with the things that the Kevin MacDonald demonstrates of the pattern behavior among the Jewish intellectual elites once they get in power. Very interesting stuff. Where it's going, I'm not quite sure, but someone knows something about them. Yeah, because when you have middle, you know, the largest group to come into Talmudism comes out of this whole entire sector, comes out of the section. If you read back, now the modern day Eastern European Jewry looks a far cry from what they did 100 years ago. 100 years ago, I think it was a little more honest. There's plastic surgery now. There's all the different types of things they can do. I think it's a provocative theory. Not by what Mr. Bradley's saying necessarily, but what modern science is saying. Because I didn't take him all too seriously at first. Also, I think You know, when it comes to Hollywood, when it comes to information, one thing you've learned to ask from the show, hopefully, is why is this information being produced? Who benefits from this? Africans, sub-Saharan Africans, are not thought to be tons of, they don't have a big distribution of Neanderthal genes. They wouldn't have anything to benefit, and they don't own Hollywood. Indo-Europeans, I don't think I have any Neanderthal genes. I don't exhibit any of their behavior. You know, who benefits from this? You understand what I'm saying? There's only one group in Hollywood that could be benefiting from having this information out. And according to Mr. Bradley, that is European Jewry, what they found out or what someone's hiding. I think this is fascinating, because information is not produced for no reason, and what we've seen is a 180 flip from where science is telling us what Neanderthal would be at, what would be like, what his traits or her traits would be like, and how they're presented in the Geico commercials. And media is very powerful for producing stereotypes. I think it's provocative. That alone makes me suspicious. That alone makes me suspicious. And all you have to do is go live in the ghetto for a while. Look at how Africans are portrayed in Hollywood. Go live at the ghettos of Detroit, on the east side of Detroit or something, Michigan. And then look at how they're presented in Hollywood, and then look at the actual crime statistics. You'll see it. You'll see something there. All you have to do for this is look at what they're saying the Neanderthals would be like. 2 times more violent than the average human. What do you define human as? They're several times more violent than us. They would have serious problems. Then look at the way Hollywood is portraying them. That's the problem I have with this. It's what I see to be true. Encino Man is not a realistic portrayal. The Geico caveman is not a realistic portrayal of Neanderthals. These articles coming out from our enemies are not realistic. And all these parties have one thing in common. All these parties say race doesn't exist. Let me just tell you something. The other side of the equation is scratching their heads saying, well, wait a minute now. And the Germans know something again. And that's my next point. This is even more interesting. I was asked, in light of this information, would I change my view on the Nazis lighting candles in the Middle East? I've always talked about, you know, you can't light a candle without a wick. And the Nazis went into the Middle East as a fact and were tooling with Islam. They were basically, the Muslims contacted them and they wanted to work with them, so they gave them, they helped translate the Mein Kampf. And they are accused of being sparking this huge anti-Semitic rage. What you see now going on in Islam. And I'm going to talk about this for a little bit. Might they not have been lighting a candle? Might they have found out something and been lighting sticks of dynamite? Because what we have is one side of the equation in Europe using this little, using the little Jew rabbit as a big weapon, especially their elites, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution, the French Revolution, hell, even now in Hollywood. I believe they're by and large used. To some extent, they're partners and they're used. There's other groups in there. The other group would be the banksters, which are widely, mostly part Jewish, I believe, at least. Definitely came in under Talmudism. Even before the modern Jew had Talmudism, they had Talmudism. And in Rome, this goes back to Rome, and then we have another group on top of that that I'm interested in, the Leedsters. But what we see after World War II is we see the Nazis going right into the toxic lozenge, right into this area. And they are ensuring they're lighting candles. They're lighting candles, and those candles would have a very big wick. There might even be a fuse, and that fuse loaded to boxes of dynamite, because most of these rabbits we know now, even if the science is only half true, even if they're only 10% Neanderthal, these big distributions in the Middle East could not control their behavior. They would be incapable of turning it off. When you see the Netanyahus and you see the Ahmadinejads, they may not be able to control it. You know, you can't fight your own genes. So it's like the other side of the equation is building up their little Neanderthal rabbits. They're making sure that they get a violent variation of Islam, and Islam has several. Islam can be extremely violent historically, and they're ensuring that. They're ensuring that they get Mein Kampf. You know, the little Muslim rabbits are asking for help, and they're definitely helping them out. They're ensuring that. And so as we come into World War III, might it have been that the little Nazi rabbits didn't light candles so much? They lit candles right next to fuses, and those wicks, those big long wicks, are attached to big sticks of dynamite. And no one can control this. You got one side that can't be controlled, ready to dance into the ring of fire. I call them like, you know, in like Lord of the Rings, I call little Jew rabbits like little Gollum. Gollum can't help it at the end. He has to dance in the fire with that ring. He can't escape his genetics. And now, of course, you may have another side of the equation that can't help it either. And both, one side is well outbred the other side. One side definitely was working with the Nazis. So it all comes back. We can't escape this. But what did they find out? What did they find out? You know, this group we can't escape walks right into the middle of the toxic lozenge of all the groups in the third world to work with. And let's face it, Nazism has took off all over the world. You know, you got symbols showing up in Thailand that were in their T-shirts. But I'm talking about who did they work with? Right out in front of the open. Who did they go out of their way to work with once they were contacted? Well, that was most certainly the Muslims. And they were most certainly, they had groups in it doesn't take a lot of them either. They had groups of Nazis in the Middle East. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. And so as we enter World War III, we have two groups going at it. At the tip of the spear, if you will. One group heavily bred up, expanded birth rates under a violent variation of Islam. You've got basically almost the Sunni and the Jew rabbits coming together to face off against the Shia. And the Shia are basically Ahmadinejads doing the Germans high step and praising the Germans. But none of these sides may be able to turn it off. They may be too far gone. And so World War One was the war against whoever had the most Nordics. World War Two was like the war against whoever had the bigger European populations. World War Three might be whoever has the most Neanderthals. It's crazy stuff. But when you look at information, my first question is, why is this being produced? Who knows something? Why are you making Neanderthals look so nice and wonderful when none of the scientists I trust would ever say that? That's not an honest portrayal. There's a big difference between Quest for Fire and Encino Man. There's a big difference from the scientists that are being quoted, the German scientists, and what's going on at this stuff coming out of the Washington Post. We have an interesting situation here, and I am agnostic on where it's going to go, other than there's a trend in place. And Neanderthals are nice and wonderful, and there's another trend in place. Neanderthals are extremely violent, and there's sectors of humanity, 1 to 4% humanity is infected with their genes, and that's all concentrated in one particular area. Oh my. Oh my. And it's widely known, for those non-racialists listening to this, it's widely known that the Khazar kingdom did in fact exist, that Khazaria was an area in the Caucasus, in this whole entire area that they migrated, Eastern European Jewry adopted Talmudism and migrated later into Europe. What would this mean? How much of Europe's infected? I don't know. I don't even know. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, you're dealing with maybe the reason they're elites. Whatever migrates to the top of has to exhibit these behavior patterns to get the command of the other Neanderthals. It's a wild, wild curveball. But science ultimately rules. And the thing that indicts it, the thing that always bothered me about this, especially over the past 4 or 5 months, is that what I know to be true in the media is that they lie. And they are going out of their way in cultural, in a modern pop cultural trend to make the caveman harmless and cool. He would be anything but harmless. He may be clever, which kind of shocked me. I always thought the Neanderthal was stupid. He may be clever, but he would not be harmless. These were violent, violent creatures. And any hybrid based on that would also have tendencies that they could not turn off. They wouldn't be capable of that. You can't fight your own genetics. Interesting food for thought. And in this next little piece, I'm going to throw in a question and answer in regarding some of the wild topics I've conversed with in Babylonian text. And I'm going to answer who I think would be the god of the Neanderthals. because they believe, it doesn't matter what I believe, it doesn't matter what you believe. It matters what the Jew rabbits believe. Jew rabbits believe they have a connection to their god, a little gene. They believe it enough that they can test for it and you won't get into Israel if you don't have it. They also believe that it's carried by the female strain. Well, that's interesting in itself. They also believe it's not necessarily recessive. In other words, you breed with a Jew rabbit female or a female, and those traits are going to become dominant. They're not even worried about it. They seem to be. I mean, they're constantly marrying certain daughters of certain elements of European royalty, and they believe it'll take their traits, and it appears to be somewhat true. Wild card. What I don't like about them is that their elites go out of their way to be pro-white genocide. And you can look at the YouTube videos, Jews will play a major role in multicultural Europe, and how the lady said Jews are going to be hated for what they're doing in Europe. Just watch. And she's quite okay with that. That's what I don't like them. They seem to be at war with everything. And there may be a logical reason. And the little Nazi rabbits, once again, may appear on the scene. They may have given them the match. You know, you got your little, you Anglo elites got your little Neanderthal rabbits. Well, we're breeding up a big toxic brew, too. And we're going to make sure they have the most violent ideology versions of Islam ever available. We're going to cater to that gene pool's level for violence. You know, giving this gene pool anything part Neanderthal, giving them something like the Talmud would also be extremely dangerous. They might have added to it, but I don't think they invented it. This comes back to Babylon. And I know these little Neanderthals weren't in Babylon. This is a little bit different. Something more is different going on. But the three different elements of the group I laid out for you, and those are my ideals on it. And, of course, the Neanderthal spin in modern science, which always rules, lays it wide open. Lays a big question mark on a few things. I have more questions than answers, but one of the things that always bothered me is how our enemy operates in the media and what I'm seeing about the presentation of Neanderthals in the press and Neanderthals in popular culture. And I don't like it when I see a 180, when I see a divergence from reality, a divergence from science. There's a far cry from how Africans are presented in the media to how they really are on the streets of Detroit, or on the streets of Cleveland, or on the streets of Los Angeles. There's a far cry for how Mexicans are presented in the media than how they really are. There's a far cry. And that's what bothers me. I know damn well that Neanderthal or something part Neanderthal would have serious violent tendencies and be seriously incompatible with humanity based on what I've read, based on the sciences I trust. And I would encourage you to do your own research, and I'm just pointing out the obvious. That's all this show is about. And so if I'm going to talk about these groups, I'm going to talk about them in a way you never heard before. I'm going to try to point out something, add something to the discussion. It's not already there, but it's an eye-opener, and this is pretty recent. The last 6 months, they start leveling us with this stuff, which is interesting, isn't it? Coming right into 2012, coming into World War III. So when you see Ahmadinejad on TV, do I think he's part Neanderthal? I have no idea. You're dealing with populations that couldn't control their behavior, really. When they're going to go at it, they're going to go at it. You might as well stand back and let them. Who knows? Who knows? I don't think, they're talking about Jews. I thought myself that they might make the Jews do a peace deal. I don't know. Yeah, can they turn it off? No. If you read the pattern of behavior of the release, they can't turn this stuff off. I've grew up around enough of the different Muslim populations, not so much the Sunni, but especially the Shia. And I know there are two types. There's one that is pretty much normal. It doesn't matter whether they're pretty much all Arab or one of the ones that are more Eurasian or more European-minded. They're not violent at all. They're pretty normal. And then there's another variety out of the Middle East, out of the North Africans. And we see these running around Europe raping, killing, murdering, running around Australia raping, killing, murdering. There's a place in America, Dearborn, Michigan, and it's one of the largest Shia populations outside of the Middle East. And there's two varieties there, if you go there. I've been there. I know about it. There's two varieties. One that is very sensible, that you can agree with all day long, and some of them, I believe, are all European, green eyes, so on and so forth. You know, out of places, especially out of Lebanon. Lebanon was a big Roman province. There's another variety that, there's cop cars showing up at their big high schools every day. Why? Because they can't control themselves. And that doesn't make the news. But it's interesting. It's interesting theory. Fascinating stuff. But World War III may be very well the fight to the death among the Neanderthals. Our green goddess may have set these little rabbits up. They met their own match, maybe. Interesting. Fascinating. And we'll keep it tuned into this discussion. And we'll keep it going, and I'm going to answer a few questions in the next little bit. So in closing that section, there may be a legitimate reason post-World War II of this weird treatment of the Jews. They're avoiding the average Jew rabbit. They're not provoking them. Well, if you got little werewolves, why turn them into werewolves? They might not be able to turn it off. You got to find a way around it or over it. Because we don't see any of the groups that engaging the Jews. There's only a handful doing it, and those that do it pay a big price. Some of them, I believe, are more supportive than we think, but by and large, they're a little weapon, and there's been a weapon built up against them. The whole truth of the matter, we'll have to stay tuned. But the direction of the truth in this stuff goes in some pretty interesting areas. The next section is going to be a Q&A. The Q&A goes back to some wild topics. The Babylonian text, the Babylonian epics, my ideals on certain things, what I would expect to see first. One of the things that has surprised me about that particular recording, because on this podcast I go in areas no one has ever went online, at least from a racial perspective, is how many white rabbits have emailed me thanking that they believe Marduk is here or Nergal is here. And they would be the falling angels, the Nephilim. They wouldn't be big spooks. You'd be dealing with aliens. And of course, that's nothing you would see unless you were in some big, big position of power. You wouldn't see them until the end. I don't really get upset over that. I hope they are here, because if we survive this long with them, we can survive a little bit more. And of course, they would have been left here high and dry after an ancient war, and they wouldn't have even had air conditioning until we made it for them. They would have had a lot of problems. Of course, once you go that route, there's many other things you need to understand. One, what's coming here for them? That's the interesting point. So it doesn't bother me. But what I would expect to see, if it's going in any crazy, wild scenarios, I would expect to see the basics. You plant a meme, you come back to the meme, the Stargate thing, the ancient aliens, all this stuff that's coming down the pipeline, I would expect it to get kicked up a notch. What I would expect to see coming in, and this is, I'm speaking, I don't do all these, these podcasts are not necessarily released the moment I get them done necessarily. But this is something I touched on weeks and weeks ago. These particular topics. So if you haven't listened to the whole entire podcast from beginning to end, this is not a Q&A you will understand. But one thing I will say is that I expect them to come back to this meme in a very visual outgoing way. If it's going to go that direction, it's going off-world, because you're not dealing with big spooks. And most of us that read the Bible, the Old Testament, we don't know what the hell we're reading. I'm sorry. I'm going to be that blatant to you. If it goes this direction, and I don't have a problem with it doing that, because I know what's coming here. I know I have a good idea what's coming here. So I don't have a problem with that, but you got to understand, for the yin, there's yang. So getting worried about big fallen angels being here, get worried about them partnering with aliens, and maybe they have. But for yin, there's yang. There's something coming for them, and they've been set up. And it's that simple, because they don't have a new world order. We're still here, and you're right on top of 2012. If something's here, I know damn well that the Mayan calendar is not the Mayan calendar, it's the Nertus calendar. You see, so there's yin, there's yang. If I see a big, I was asked about, let me go into a direct discussion. But before I do that, I'm going to say quite frankly, they'll come back to the meme. It'll be over the top. It'll be overbearing. What do I mean by that? I expect it to come down a mainstream channel. You might see the United Nations appoint some ambassador to Mars or Little Green Men or something silly, something that's just laughable. You might see the Catholic Church make more comments about aliens. You might very well see generals come on TV from NATO or somewhere in Russia even, or the Middle East, or even in America. You'll see generals and military officials talk about talking about UFOs shutting down missile silos or something crazy like that. They're going to talk about aliens. They're going to talk about it in a very formal way. They're going to talk about it in a what you see is what you get way. You see, they've come back to a meme over and over again. Sooner or later, you're going to go with it or you're not. But if there's something like that trapped here, it will be go big or go home. They're going to be pressed for time, and they're going to have to go very big. And forget about White Rabbit genocide for a minute, which is what they would be about. They would be about killing us and also needing us on some level, and I don't fully understand it. But they would definitely be behind it. It's a rational explanation. I have no reason to believe that Marduk or the Nurgals are not here. And who is Marduk? Marduk is Prince, the great prince, Satnal. Who you think of as Satnal. Which one of the L is the El Shaddai? Well, it's not pronounced El Shaddai, it's pronounced El Shaddu. And it's the one Amy Grant's singing a song to. El Shaddai, El Shaddai. And he's a Ben-O-El Elohim, or the son of the Lord. One of the sons of Eah. You know, that whole particular pantheon that lost. Yeah, Satan lost. Literally. Lost it all. He has a brother. His brother, which one's Lucifer? Well, his brother's the cherub that covereth. That's what Nurgal's called, and that is Lucifer. We think of them being one and the same. They are not. They are not at all, but they are both evil. If something like that exists, I don't care, because something's coming for them. And that something would be titled God. That's his title. Are they monotheistic? Yeah, I've told this before. It's monotheistic in a sense that they only believe in one creator, the Holy One who judges all in scales. But they are not it. Yeah, they are something just bigger in nature to us. Yeah, God is not the creator. That's one of the problems. We think in terms of, if you go to the United Kingdom, you're going to see a House of Lords. You know, you're going to walk around the House of Lords, there's all these different lords, but none of them are the Lord. They're just using that. Those are just titles. Those titles mean something, though. At one time, they meant a whole lot. They, cause all kinds of problems for the average little serf rabbit in Europe. But this is a pantheon of this type. And one of the head of the pantheon's title is God, the Lord of Heavens. That's his title. So there's a differentiation between God, the Creator, and God being his title. You know, this is something, of course, you wouldn't know the difference if something like that arrived here. Now, you wouldn't know the difference at all. Something bigger in nature doesn't really respond in the same way. Well, I'll go into that in a minute. But what I would expect, quite simply, is I would expect it to go off-world, quite simply. In a very formal way, I would expect mainstream news channels to get geared up. I'd expect it to go off-world. If something like that's here with us, if it's going to go crazy, let it go crazy. That's not bad for us. We just got to roll with it. And you might see the serpent lose its tail. In World War III, how the Jews get treated, what exactly happens to them, and how this comes about, how they lose this group, it tells me everything. And that's what I went into. I've answered these questions, but I got asked a very direct question about a very direct quote and what I think about it, and I'm going to read it to you. The strategy that Wernher von Braun taught me was first the Russians are going to be considered the enemy, then terrorists would be identified, and that was soon to follow. Then we were going to identify third world country crazies, we now call them nations of concern. But he said that would be the third enemy against whom we would build space-based weapons. The next enemy was asteroids. Now at this point he kind of chuckled the first time he said it. Asteroids, against asteroids we were going to build space-based weapons. And the funniest thing of all was what he called aliens, extraterrestrials. Well, I've been asked a direct quote about what it is, and this is Mr. Stephen Greer's particular novel in 2001, and this was in the 80s when von Braun was obviously alive. He worked with Dr. Carol Rosen, and he told this to her. Do I believe it? Sure, why not? What you're dealing with is when you're dealing with Wernher von Braun is a Nazi. He died a Nazi. Yeah, that we haven't heard the end of these guys yet. He died a Nazi. And what he's doing, he's not telling you their position. He's telling you what our enemy's going to do. Our enemy thought that it could run its game over and over again on a larger and larger basis until 2050, 2080, until it had the new world order. Worst case scenario, we'll just kill a lot of people and get a new world order. And they came out with bigger and bigger ways to do it. Fake asteroid invasions, fake alien invasions. You can do your homework on it. That's what he's talking for. He's talking about your enemy. And of course, the Nazis on some level had to deal with them. How do we know that? Well, he's working at NASA. He's working at NASA. Our enemy made some type of deal with the devil, and that deal went sour. I'm interested in why it went sour and what they've set up. They've obviously set these guys up. Yeah, your little Jew rabbit sitting in the Middle East, you've been set up. Everything behind you, the pink rabbit, the banksters, the elitesters have obviously been set up. That's plain as day to me. By what or whom? Well, we'll see. What's behind them? What's behind the Pharisees? What happened in Babylon is, you know, these are all questions for any of this to be valid, because I'm kind of agnostic on a lot of it. I don't know what to believe. I just know the direction if we start going into a lot of if-thens. But if it goes this route, I expect it to go extraterrestrial, because they will be pressed for time. You know, once you go this route, you basically open up Pandora's box of if-thens in my mind. It's not one equation. It's several different things that immediately come into play. And that there's something coming here. There's a second coming. Well, you better go big. You better go real big if something like that's coming here, because these guys wouldn't stand a chance. Especially if the only way, they got an inferior physics to their competitor. And of course you go into a wild Pandora's box of, you know, I've already talked about what the Nazis were doing. They were trying to light beacons to the winning side of the Pantheon. You're dealing with God and God's Son. You know, you're dealing with all these different topics coming down one particular, you know, you're dealing with Enlil and Ninurta. They're busy trying to light beacons to them. Well, all this becomes true in one big blink of an eye. It may go that route. I don't know until I see something. But I'm not really afraid of it. What happens in this equation is you worry about Marduk being here. You worry about something like this. You worry about little aliens, and there's a lot of them out there that worry about this type of thing. But you don't understand what the antithesis of that. Something would be well aware of it. And the Nazis, I'm sorry, they didn't die. They didn't die the way we think they died. And they're doing a lot more than we think. And they believe something so strongly they're willing to die for it. So I'm not really worried about yen. I'm more interested in if it goes yen, that's fine. Let's see yang. If Marduk's here, wonderful. I was asked, do I believe he'd be the god of the Jews? No. No, there's a connection between these little what may be the Neanderthal, right? Well, let's remember the Hyksos of Egypt. That's one big scenario in my mind. The Hyksos of Egypt, they had a dubious origin from the east. That would be in this toxic lozenge. They would most likely be part of Neanderthal too. I'm interested in the background, what happened in Babylon, what happened in Egypt, and exactly one of the interesting things about the Hyksos-O, let me make my point, is that they exalted Set as a high god, but their god was not in the Egyptian pantheon. That's interesting, that because the Egyptian pantheon is the same as Babylonians, it's the same as the Greeks. You just got to know how to put the names together. It's the same as the Norse. Yeah, Zeus and all these, Zeus is Odin. Thor is Phoebus Apollo, that type of thing. Ninurta. So you got to know how to put it together. But one thing they maintained is that their god is not our god, and their god's not in that pantheon. So that brings in another Pandora's box. Did the losing side, negotiate something with some little bug-eyed alien devils? I have no idea. I don't know what to know. I don't know what to think about this stuff if it goes this direction. I'll put it together, though. Hopefully I'll put it together. But I expect, like I said, if these guys are here, they're going to give us a gift to straighten things out. They're going to give you a big clue. And it's not a bad thing, but it's something I'll talk about that again in a minute. But when it comes down to Wernher von Braun, and these are very difficult subjects for me to go into. It's very difficult to do this type of thing in a WAV file and then put it to MP3 and then go on record, because it's crazy stuff. It'll be even crazier if something starts happening along these lines, because our race might very well be the byproduct of an extraterrestrial pantheon whose title is God. That's who runs the show, and you'll know it. I was asked, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between these guys. They could tell you whatever they want to tell you. There's no way you could do anything. If Marduk and Nergal have been here, have been tracing into these time frames, waiting for their last move, trying to create a blended humanity, if they're behind this, partnering with some off-world species, the only thing you could do if you were the Nazis is light a beacon, cut a deal, run and hide, and get ready for the fire. Get ready for the fireworks. That's all you could do. So I've been asked, do I think I'm agnostic on whether or not I think they're here. I've seen nothing to tell me they were here, and I've seen nothing to tell me they're not here. But something has made some very odd moves. The top of Europe is doing very unnatural things. We have elements of White Rabbit society that do very unnatural things. And anytime you see something unnatural, it might have an off-the-wall natural explanation that we don't yet see. We don't know anything like that till the end, but one thing I do know is it will go off-world. They will have to move quickly. Because, again, you're in this set of if-thens. If any of this is true, then 2012 wasn't just some Mayan calendar. That's Ninurta's calendar. That's Phoebus Apollo. If something like that's going to get here in 2012 from who knows what opening up in the solar system, who knows? Stargates, whatever. If something like that is coming, God and the angels, that's who you're talking about. They don't come from Chicago. If something like that's coming, you better go big. You better do something drastic right now. Because what I see right now, they got problems in the Middle East. They got problems all over the place. You're going to have to do something drastic on this planet. A big knockoff World War III. Maybe lose the Jews. I don't know. The beast is going to have to come out of the pit. They're going to have to do... The Red Hippo's got to move. Because these are the big lightning throwers. These are the big hunters. That's all I'll say about that. If you've listened to this whole entire series, I don't know, these topics are wild stuff. But I would expect them to come back to the meme. They'll come back to the meme. They will speed it up. They will go faster and faster. But eventually you're going to have to bring it down to mainstream channel. Eventually you're going to have to do something crazy, like the United Nations have an ambassador to Venus or something, to meet little Venus aliens or something crazy like that. Eventually you're going to have to, even if you're planning some big deception, you're going to have to do these things. Eventually, you're going to have to bring it down mainstream channels. Eventually, it's going to have to make Fox News very formal. Maybe a general comes out and says, you know what? UFOs shut down missile silos and stuff like that, which they did do. Now, who were they? Well, I have a simple explanation on who they were. They were Nazis. They're not going to say that, though. You might very well enter into a situation, if these guys are here, that they may pull off a fake alien invasion, or try to, and try to get us to fight God. Who knows? Who knows? Let me explain to you something about these texts. I've been asked this other question directly. But in closing that one, in closing this, because, again, these are not easy topics to go over, I expect it to go very much in your face and down your throat, alien, off-world, extraterrestrial, because you're not dealing with big spooks in the sky. And if one of these guys gets here, one of these guys gets out, when they start making their moves, you're going to know that. But the Dr. Carol Rosen statement, I don't know if Wernher von Braun said it or not, but one thing is true, that's exactly what they've done. They've had nations of concern. They've had war against terrors. I mean, this was done in the 80s. He supposedly said this in the 80s, and that's precisely what's happened. They've had all kinds of stuff on TV about asteroids. The meme is out there, asteroids hitting the Earth. They've had all kinds of memes out there from Independence Day, which was made years after this, about alien invasions, thwarted. So what he's doing is talking for our enemy. Our enemy had all this set up until they get their new world order. But our enemy, depending on how you take them apart, there are three components, and there may very well be something behind that third component, something here. I don't know that. If you believe the Bible, that's what you believe. You know, you're not dealing with what you think you're dealing with. That's the only thing I can tell you. What you're dealing with in kindergarten, what you're dealing with in catechism, is not what this stuff is. It's not what it is, and we don't know what we're reading. The good news is that he's pretty cool. You know, I was asked, you know, when these texts actually have plenty of episodes of them showing up on the scene. Now, the first coming was a pretty violent episode of them showing up in the scene. I don't know exactly what it was about, but he comes like a thief in the night, and they roll out here. And I was asked, what would they do? You know, wipe out most of the planet, then drag out the pink rabbit banksters and throw them in pools of fire and stuff like that. That's what they do. As crazy as it sounds, that's what they do. That's what I laughed. I laughed, what are they going to do? Throw them in pools of fire? That's what they do. When you're reading the book of Revelations, that's what this stuff, I mean, they didn't get that from nowhere. That's what this stuff reads like. You know, it's Judgment Day. We've heard that term, Judgment Day. Well, it's Judgment Day. And to all those that think Neil or Ninurta or these guys are cruel, wow, Zeus seems pretty cool to me. That's who you're dealing with. Seems pretty cool to me. He doesn't say anything about him being nice. Doesn't say anything about him being cruel, although he's pretty cool to us. He's cool to us. He's not cruel to us. It says he's just. He's considered just. And he would line them up and crucify them. No in-betweens. There's also another cool, if it goes this aspect, we can't die if we die. As long as two white rabbits remain, we can make it back, fight again. It's a pretty wild concept. You're going to this concept of that we have souls that don't die, this whole entire concept of consciousness. So once you go into this direction, there's a Pandora's box that opens up in front of you. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it can be pretty scary if you're not prepared for it. Because most of us going to catechism or going to Sunday school, we don't know what on earth we're reading, and that's been done intentionally. Not that it's not true. I have a feeling this New Testament may be entirely true. Just not true in the way anyone thinks it's true. And there's really nothing you can do except hope that he gives you a big layup. So when it comes down to the Nazis and what they're talking about, what Wernher von Braun, he's giving you your enemy's playbook. He's giving us the Red Hippo's playbook. But the Red Hippo is now pressed for time. If the Red Hippo comes out with alien stuff, the Red Hippo is beyond pressed for time. And that's not a bad thing for us. That's not a bad thing for us, because you may get Judgment Day coming here. That's not bad for us. Of course, I play a very simple game. So it doesn't matter if you're a 25-foot alien named Aryan God. I play a very simple game. Me a white rabbit, you a white rabbit. And he asks an iron question. That's precisely what he would ask. Now, as far as, I don't know. I don't know what you could do about such scenarios except put on your hip waders and walk around pointing out, put out your neck waders and point out the sinners, because blood would flow to the horse's bridle. These guys are killing machines. And, you know, I've been told that they think Neil and these guys are very cruel, because when they show up, they wipe out a lot of people. It's happened before. It's in these texts, basically. Well, the way I look at it is, imagine you're a farmer and you're going into a pen full of little chickens. And part of your chickens have the bird flu. Well, you got to pick up, you got to test your little chickens, and you're going to have to kill some of them. Now, when you first walk in, and we're the little chickens in this case, the big farmer walks in. Something bigger than nature just walked in. Something smaller than nature does not judge something bigger than nature. Something smaller than nature does not understand something bigger than nature. You can't comprehend it. We're just little chickens. You know, little chickens can't understand the farmer. They're just scared. You know, they don't know they had the bird flu. They don't know anything. They're the little chickens. The key that morning is to not end up a chicken nugget. But, it's kind of funny stuff, but I expect to get some kind of gift. You know, I've said before that if it goes that route, that's fine. I expect to see the final solution with no air pollution. Most of these people think Jesus didn't exist. I assume all this stuff is real, just not true in the way we think it's true, because our enemy doesn't create necessarily. They just make stuff their own. They pollute stuff. So I expect to see something like that, and I expect most of the Christians to be miffed and terrified. Because our enemy's New World Order, everyone I know of does not include a Jesus. It doesn't include the fine, it doesn't include that, because their partner is a little Jew rabbits on some level. So if it includes that, either they're in such trouble they gotta put it in there, or the other side's trying to send us a message that they're here and they got the solar system on lockdown or something. As crazy as that sounds. I'll know when I see it, and I'll know exactly based on what this little Jesus looks like. He will be razzle dazzle. You would not be able to kill him. He will be annihilating things. He will not be forgiving Jews. He will be killing Jews. The what you see is what you get, Israel. What you think of Israel, and basically the little Jew rabbits. I expect to see it. I expect the winning side of the pantheon to give the little Jew rabbits exactly what they gave us. That's right. A Jesus they couldn't spit out and they can't swallow, and that they've constantly used to divide us up based on religion and cause wars based on religion. I expect the end-all, be-all, the knockdown, drag-out, the final solution with no air pollution. And if Ninurta's listening to me, well, that's what I expect to see. I expect to see something. Because sooner or later, push comes to shove, you know, you got to go or get off the pot. But if they go aliens, I don't care. That's fantastic. It may answer a lot of questions that I don't have, because I don't have a logical question of someone trying to wipe out their founding gene pool. You're dealing with very unnatural stuff. So unnatural stuff a lot of times gets these white fantasy rabbits dealing with unnatural explanations. It may be just that. Maybe there's something natural that we don't realize yet. That's fine. I open it up to possibilities. I'll have to see something first. Of course, there's a big problem with that. We don't see anything anyways. We don't see light, we see light reflecting off, or we don't see each other, we see light reflecting off what we believe to be each other. So we are easily fooled. Now, to answer the last question, I got asked a crazy question. Well, what I call a crazy question. If you want to, anyone can put out a podcast, but once you put out a podcast, if you talk about crazy subjects, sometimes you get crazy questions, which is fine. I entertain everything. But in short, the Nazis weren't talking about what they were going to do. They were talking about what our enemy's going to do, and it's quite obvious someone set someone up. Now, how it goes, we'll have to see. I'll have to see World War III. I'll have to see if these guys are crazy enough to go off world. If it goes off world, I'm going to repeat that. Some of these scenarios I've talked about, I may be dead right, I'm guessing. I may be dead right. I may get lucky for you. Who knows? But I'm going to answer another question regarding one of these UFO series I was asked to watch by a listener, and I'm going to be back for in a second. So if any of these previous topics over the past few minutes confused you, it's because you haven't listened to the old series and you haven't followed something. I say a whole lot in these things. I try to cover everything. God forbid I try to predict white rabbit behavior and try to predict what those Nazis really do or what they were really about, because you're going to get it wrong. No one has ever predicted white rabbit behavior. It's not possible. We do the crazy stuff and make it normal. But I was asked a question, and many of you have seen these shows about UFOs, and there's two dominant shapes of UFOs, and I was asked what I see when I see them, and I can't really respond to an email like that because it's a book, but I can respond to it very shortly. I watched a series, and there's the big triangles, right? The big triangles. The big triangles may very well be Team Pink Rabbit. I don't know who's what. I don't know who's what in this. I don't know. I assume they're U.S. I assume they're military. I assume it's White Rabbit military stuff. Different militaries around the world, whether Russia, the United States especially, developing different things. But that doesn't mean there couldn't be something bigger in nature. You never know until it shows up on your doorstep. But I was asked specifically, there's these episodes in the United States, and I don't know if you've ever been on any of these websites, but if you're not on any of these websites talking about extraterrestrials, talking about UFOs, they are not small. The Rents.coms, when they go in these subject matters, they got huge hits. When I talk about this stuff, a lot of people download it to listen to different alternative, different theories. Interesting stuff. Whatever works. Obviously they're seeing something. I've never seen anything personally, but I know those that have. I always assume it's military. The night vision goggle thing I've talked about, I've always assumed it's military testing stuff. Because we're always testing stuff and it doesn't show up until the last minute. But there's been two dominant ones, these big triangle type things, and who do I think those are? I have no idea. The other one I had an interest in. I have an interest in because it reminded me of something. The triangle one reminds me of the pyramid, which would be more Anglo. That would be more Anglo, at least, I think. But I don't know. For all I know, it could be little gray aliens. But I will answer your question. The big V's. They had these episodes with the flying V's, the giant flying V's going over going over Phoenix, and the guys that recreated them, the guy that saw them, he definitely saw something. I don't know they didn't see our military, but they were coming up from South America, or they've been seen in South America as well. But I was asked that to me does not look like a flying V. I was more interested in that than anything else. And right now on my Twitter, I put something up for this particular listener and anyone else. Those big flying Vs look like something I am interested in. They don't look like Vs, and they don't look like As. They look like lambdas. Now, lambda is a very interesting term, and I'm not talking about the local gay fraternity. Yeah, there's like, in America, we have these lambdas, and they're like a faggot rabbit fraternity or something. I don't know. But I'm not talking about the gay rabbit fraternity. I'm talking about the Greek. Letter lambda, and there's multiple different meanings for this thing, but it was on the Spartan shield. It's an upside-down V. And the reason it interests me is it goes back to Greece, and it goes back to a certain character in Greece. We know the temples of Phoebus Apollo were built to like so many lambdas. This symbol, this term comes up again and again in ancient Greece. Many believe the Spartan shield referred to a territory. And that's probably true, but it, like many symbols, it has multiple different meanings. And on my website, I have the wiki for lambda, the particular symbol lambda. It looks like a giant V. What's interesting about this is one thing that's always stuck out in my mind is, and I'm going to put up in this on my Twitter as well, there's something called Space Facts, and I believe this is out of Germany. This is an English edition. And it talks about all the different Apollo missions and the different patches and the different astronauts on the missions. And I'm going to put up one for Apollo 11. And on Apollo 11, this is a space mission. This is NASA's space mission, which is a very interesting space mission. You're going to see an Apollo patch, an Apollo sticker that they brought out. And one has the Eagle. The Eagle has landed, Apollo 11. The other has Apollo and NASA. And I want you to look at it. And that's precisely what those giant Vs look like to me. They look like a lambda. Now, what's interesting about this particular Apollo-NASA patch is you have a lambda. The lambda then becomes the letter A. It becomes a letter A because you have the stars of Orion going through it. When we're back again to Orion and Phoebus Apollo. And who's Phoebus Apollo in Babylonian text? Well, he's Ninurta. Who's Ninurta? That's who the Nazis were trying to contact. Ninurta and Nil. Zeus and Apollo. That type of thing. Odin and Thor. You get the picture. But that's the symbol. That's what it reminds me of. So the triangles, I don't know, maybe someone's duping a pyramid. We work with the triangle shape all the time. A lot of times when you get those big flying wings, they look like big triangles. So to me, it looks like something like that from the Anglo-American elite. Maybe our enemies. The other side is much more interesting to me because it looks like a flying lambda. And we know that the temples to Phoebus Apollos all dealt with this symbol, a lambda. And, you know, even when you look up lambda on wiki, it means something like, lambda can mean empty set in mathematics. And it talks about the different meanings in modern ancient Greece and, the plot of land it was supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be this area in ancient Greece. But I do know that this comes from the temples to Phoebus Apollo. And I think it's interesting that it's showing up on NASA patches. And I think it's interesting that you have flying ships looking just like that. Interesting coincidence. I don't know about coincidences, but it is interesting. But I answer all questions, and that's what it looks like to me. The triangles look like a giant flying wing of some sort. I've never seen either. And the big Vs look like they don't look like Vs, and they don't look like As. They look like lambdas. But it has everything to do with what we've been talking about in these particular areas. Interesting stuff. We won't know anything until we see something, but if it's going to go off-world, it'll be rather obvious. And then there's several different if-thens, and they all come live at once. Yeah, we're not operating in a vacuum. A lot of these alien researchers worry about these little gray aliens being with us. I don't. Let's get it on. Because I can tell you what's coming here. What's coming here, we'll get it on. Oh, and by the way, we can't even die. Yeah, we have souls that don't die. All you need is give me two white rabbits, and I'll be running around like Harry Potter's ghost, and I'll get back in this world. Funny stuff. Crazy stuff. Well, let's get crazy. But that doesn't scare me. Marduk coming out, Nergal coming out and attacking, that doesn't scare me because I know what's coming. We just got to hang on. I mean, we hung on this far. We can hang on a few more minutes. It would be great for our race for it to go off-world. Fantastic. Because our next big adventure would be going to whatever world these sorry animals come from and taking that world or destroying it. I can assure you that. But that's my answer to your question. I'll put those up. All this stuff is going to be up on my Twitter. There's going to be several stuff on my Twitter so you can follow along. Things that make you go, things that make you think a little bit. But these questions are very, very difficult, and it's very difficult to put something like this in a podcast, and I would rather not talk about it, but who knows when something may come live. But if something like that exists, he's going to help us out. He's going to reconcile Pisces. He's going to reconcile this age you're in. This age you're in is a Piscean age. It's the age of Judeo-Christianity and Islam. One can only imagine. One can only imagine what he'd do, but my guess is they would do the unthinkable. You would get a Jesus, and he will be a final solution with no air pollution. It will not be what you think. But at the same time, I expect him to be pretty cool to us. I expect him at least to give us a chance to get it right, because we've done nothing wrong. Yeah. What happens to the little Jew rabbits in World War III determines a lot for me. That's a totally different scenario than white rabbit genocide, but all this could be related for all I know. But this is the end of Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters, and we went out there. But anytime you're talking about things where we don't know the whole scenario, we can only go in a direction. I can only point you in a direction. And when facts change, we have to change. But the little Jew rabbits, there may be a rational reason for their treatment of them after New World, or the treatment of Pooty Poot. Pooty Poot walks around and ignores the Jews. He basically doesn't give them any power, only power over certain things. They're not allowed to control any foreign activities, not allowed to control foreign policy, not allowed to control certain critical infrastructures, but he lets them run around and do certain things. He doesn't bother with them at all. He walks in their synagogue and says, "Oh yeah, you're so wonderful." But there may be a logical reason. There may be a very logical reason. And then the other side of the equation, we know that the Germans, we know that the Russians are building up the Akhmenijads. They're building these guys up. I was asked, if I think that the Russian Jews in Russia weren't just selling Syria missiles to make an excuse for the Russians or the Jew lovers in Russia just selling missiles to Syria so that gives Israel an excuse to attack Syria. Well, under that logic, Jew loving Russia would be doing power plants in Iran to give Israel an excuse to attack Iran. You're getting a little over the top there. They do that. Yeah, they do that. The problem, reaction, solution. You sell Syria weapons, create a problem, that gets a reaction, allows you to implement a solution and attack Syria. But when you start going down that angle, you have a lot more different groups can be built up, and I'm sorry, it ain't good for the Jews. But we'll see. We'll see soon enough, and we'll carry this forward. But if you see it go off world, well, you might want to download most of these MP3s and listen to it. For all I know, I could have it right on something. Who knows? But that would just be blind luck. And it's nothing that you can't operate in a vacuum. None of this stuff should scare you. It would just be a little bit of an adjustment, I guess. We wouldn't have to worry about, you wouldn't have to worry about most of humanity, because most of them wouldn't exist. Yeah, they don't exist to these guys. That's funny stuff. But funny in a way, because God would be white. That's not a bad thing. Come on, we knew it was going to happen that way anyways. There's a God, he's white. But that's the end of this this Pink Rabbit special. And hopefully I answered all those questions, or at least you took it in a direction that you would expect from this particular podcast. The next podcast we're going to be doing, I got to do an update on white rabbit genocide, about lawsuits being fired, or actually complaints filed to the UN, and what actually that means in this day and time, because 10 years ago it was a little bit different than now. This type of thing has been done in the past. Now it's a little bit different. This is a little more unique, and I'm going to go into that, and I'm going to go into the news and views. We're going to do an update, and these will be released probably at the same time. I also have a special coming that's being worked on. I got elements of it done about white rabbit psychology and ecology. And we will continue this until we walk into the end game, which is very soon. I just have that funny feeling. This has been another episode of Horus Avengers Follow the White Rabbit, and I hope you enjoyed listening. We are now at the end of another episode of Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. And this podcast is, of course, all as always, dedicated to practical politics. But I'd like to take this time to thank you for tuning in to another episode. On behalf of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, it is yours truly, Horus the Avenger. And I'll be back with you in another episode in the near future. Until then, thank you for listening.